and you hear that telltale sort of blow, and then kind of that chirp and squeak of dolphins. And you look up, and there's like fins all around. And I grab the GoPro and like shove it underwater, and there's like 40 or 50 dolphins like swimming around the boat. I've never seen that many dolphins in one place in my life. I wish you could swim like dolphins can swim. You can beat them forever and ever. Oh, we can be heroes just for one day.
Okay, this is fucking tried. Nine. It's like, I don't know how Burr does it. He probably cuts. I assume he cuts after he has a good, like, you know, 3 minutes. And then he stops and keeps going so he can, like, cut it together. Not me. I just go one shot. It's one shot. I pause if I have to look up a date or something. And that's about it. And, I mean, it's wrong. It's the dumbest way to do it. It's so much waste of time. By the way, Toronto this week on April 6th. The Danforth Music Hall. First show sold out. Second show. Still some tickets left. And then at the end of the month, Portland, at the Aladdin Theater. First show gone. Second show. We just added a second show in Portland. And then the 27th at the Neptune in Seattle. All tickets at arithegreat.com. Anyway, this is Try Fucking Nine. On today's episode, I'm drinking this coffee. I when I was in Egypt, in Luxor, outside Luxor, the Valley of the Kings, I think it's called. They built this fucking giant temple in a mountain, kind of like in Petra. And when I was there going in, I got into Egyptian coffee. It's really ground fine coffee, and they make it in a tanika. That's what it's called. This guy told me, this shop owner told me. And it's like this coned sort of metal dish with a big handle, and you put it on super low. That's what he said, super low, until the water slowly starts to expand. And I mean, it takes like 10 minutes. And so it slowly starts to expand. It's just like ground coffee. I don't have Egyptian coffee. I don't have the tanika I bought back with me. I gave them both to a friend of mine in Oakland. But when I was in Tempe, Arizona, in the green room, in the bathroom, there was a larger tanika that I stole. Guys, at Tempe Improv, I'm sorry, I stole it. I know I shouldn't have. I don't think I deserved it. It wasn't like you guys were underpaying me or anything. It wasn't like you didn't help. We did quite, it was fun. It was a great weekend. And I saw this tanika and I wanted it. And I felt like if I asked, someone would say no. It was just being used as decoration. So I stole it. So if you want money for it, Joel or who's running the Tempe Improv now, I will pay you for it. But and I offer you a sincere apology. I should have asked, but if I had to do it again, I'd probably steal it again. I'll be honest, I'd probably steal it again because I got it, and I might not have gotten it. And I didn't expect the coffee I made because I'm not using Egyptian coffee. I'm using like fair trade, you know, Whole Foods ground coffee. But I did it good as shit. So this episode is brought to you by the Tempe Improv. How about that? If you want real, tell you what. How about a tweet for a comedian who's not doing good numbers? You let me know that, and I will tweet for them. It has to be somebody funny. It can't be somebody that I find unfunny. But I'll tell you. You tell me, how about this guy? I'm like, what else you got? And then tell me somebody else, and I'll tweet for you. Or again, I'll pay you back. I guess I could do jail time, but that seems a little excessive. I am proud of myself right now for catching myself. For going, if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't steal it. Because I would. So I'm glad I caught myself and said the truth that I would steal it again. On today's episode, Tim Crockett comes back. I don't know if you guys remember. He was on January 16th, 2018. It was my first podcast I recorded last year in a hotel room in Athens, Georgia. And his plan was to raise money for a couple really worthy causes. One cause, but a couple charities that help with the cause. He was a combat veteran in the UK, in England. I think Special Forces, something. He's a man. And he's been living in America, in Georgia, I think, for the last however many years. A long time. And veterans in both countries, and probably other countries as well, are committing suicide at, like, I mean, anyone is at an alarming rate, but this is a really alarming rate. You can look up the stats, and it's almost unbelievable. I did it once on Rogan's podcast, and we were both like, no, that's definitely wrong. That might be for a year, not a month. And then we looked at it, and it's crazy. So these two charities, what do we got? CombatStress.org and GiveAnHour.org. They're trying to help these veterans deal with their depression, with their PTSD, and with their depression in general. It's also helping loved ones of the veterans learn how to deal with depression in their family members and their friends. It's a weird thing, you guys. I mean, I guess probably a lot of you have heard by now, Brody Stevens committed suicide, and it wasn't like he wasn't giving us clues. You know, he was talking about it all the time, and generally what happens is everyone else, they just don't want to hear it because they don't want it to be true. It's not because it's ruining their day. It's just because they don't want it to be true. And so you just hope they stop talking about it, but that doesn't mean they're not still feeling the same way. So, guys, I don't sell these podcasts. I do them for free. Occasionally I have sponsors. But if you wanted to pay for it after the fact, after you know it's a good episode, go to giveanhour.org or combatstress.org. Or combatstress.org.uk, one of those two. And give $5-$10 to, I mean, honestly, a worthy cause to try to help these veterans deal with it and not fucking kill themselves. That's not what anybody wants. I want, you know, America to pull out of combat, but I don't want the troops to die, especially once they're back. But anytime. Anyway, so he did it to raise money. For a worthy cause, he decided he was going to row across the Atlantic Ocean. I want you guys to hear what I'm saying right now, because I don't think it sinks into a lot of people. He's going to row his boat across the Atlantic Ocean. Row, not sail, not do anything motorized. He was going to take a boat and row it. You're hearing me right. Across a lake? No. A Great Lake? Also would be tremendous, but no. He's going to row it across the fucking ocean, across the Atlantic Ocean. The episode we did in June 16th was episode 3. What was it? 313. Row, row, row your boat gently across the fucking Atlantic Ocean. Tim Crockett is a man. And that's what his plan was. And he got a couple sponsors on it and a few other sponsors. I think 7-Eleven. And his boat was called Tame the Kraken, and he did it as part of the Talisker Whiskey Challenge. That was his plan. That was his plan. Anyway, to row across the Atlantic Ocean. They have people who row with four people. They have two-man teams, and they had, I think, five or maybe six solo rowers. And he wanted to become one of them. And he did it. He did it. He rode across the fucking Atlantic Ocean. Can you imagine that? It took him 63 days. 63 days and a couple hours on the water by himself, rowing every day in the sun, in the storms. It didn't matter. He's rowing his boat across the fucking Atlantic. It was nuts. And I talked to him. He'd been back for about 2 weeks. He stopped through New York. And we're like, dude, let's do a follow-up podcast and see how it was. We all heard your plan, but let's hear the results. So he came over. He came over and he talked to me about what it was like to row across the Atlantic. And you know me, I had tons of questions about the food, about shitting, showering. I did not ask him about masturbating. That is a mistake on my part. Oops. And the Zoom still works. Did not ask him about masturbating. I asked him just about everything else. Yeah, it was crazy. You could see as he was talking too. He'd just been back for a couple weeks, and he got sort of misty, not misty eyed, but like far away looks. Well, as he was recounting it, it hit him. Like it struck him while he was talking what he actually did. When people do adventures or they take on feats, I don't think they realize what they're doing until afterwards. And people are like, you did what? And you're like, oh, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I guess it is crazy when you think about it. And this is, I don't know how, in what world he wouldn't think it was crazy, but I guess it got normalized for him. So he came in and talked to me. It was hard. It was hard. You know what else is hard? Your boners, everybody. Who doesn't like hard boners? My sponsor today is BlueChew.com. If you go to BlueChew.com and use the promo code Ari, you can get... That's right. It's dick pills, everybody. It's dick pills. BlueChew.com never tells me what to say in a podcast read. If you want rock hard cocks, you'll go to BlueChew.com. Use the promo code Ari. You get your first shipment absolutely free. $5 for shipping, and that's it. So I guess not absolutely free. $5. There's two different kinds of pills. You fill out the short survey of like what kind of pill do you want. You either want the kind that kicks in like 30, 40 minutes and lasts for like 5 hours, or the other kind that takes like a few hours to kick in and then it lasts for like a day and a half. Anytime you get aroused, you got rock hard cocks. BlueChew.com/Ari. Yeah. So I went through the process. They sent it to me. It comes in a fucking brown, like nondescript packaging if you're embarrassed about it. But you're only going to be embarrassed until that cock is hard. And then no more embarrassment because your cock will be so hard that whoever laughs at you, they'll be like, oh, yeah? Well, look at this. And you just show them your hard cock from BlueChew.com, promo code Ari. So anyway, yeah, guys. I mean, this is one of those where I'm like, don't support the sponsor because of me. This is one of those where it's like, support the sponsor because of you. Also, I mean, Lewis told me about it too. He goes, want some Blue Chews? Before I even got the sponsorship. yuck. I mean, it's just like, it's exactly what it is. If you want your dick hard, there's no reason to be embarrassed about it. Just fucking go get super hard. Okay, let's get back to the episode. So, we're going to start. By the way, I got a couple announcements. Tom Rhodes, you guys, you tweeted Delta, and he got his diamond status back. You guys did it. You tweeted Delta a bunch. They looked into it, and they gave him his diamond status back. We went the positive route, and it worked. We didn't have to go negative. We went positive, you guys, and it fucking worked. I just did his podcast. I'm on the latest episode of Tom Rhodes' podcast, and we talked about how they gave him his fucking diamond status back. He's over the moon, you guys. He is so fucking happy. He is so fucking happy. Anyone who tweeted, go ahead and tweet at him. It's like, I'm glad you enjoyed my gift. And by my, I mean yours, who tweeted. Man, he's just so excited. His first trip after this episode, the episode 2 weeks ago that we did together, he got upgraded to a fucking lie down bed from San Francisco to New York. So fucking you guys, great job. He's so fucking happy. What was I going to say? Oh, also, Shooter, I have now changed a little bit, fucked with this audio a little bit, so it's clear. A lot of people are saying it's the best podcast, the funniest podcast I've ever done, which is possible. Not best. That's too subjective, but funniest. What a great fucking time. The Photoshops that have come in have been tremendous. I've already spent like $200 in Photoshops. Anyone else who has one? I'm thinking of a Photoshops along the lines of Michelle Wolf is Jenny. You know, one of those? Or Giannis Pappas is one of the professors or whatever, or Ramel. I forget what his character. Things like that. But yeah, any Photoshop you have, if it's good enough for me to use on Instagram, I'll fucking use it. $25. Same goes for my special, Double Negative. So let's start the episode, you guys. I love it. I love when people fucking do things like this. He's fucking crazy, Tim Crockett. He's crazy. Now, I'm going to have pictures that he took while on the ocean. He took pictures. He slept where no one has slept. I mean, in the history of the world. He's been to places where no one was. Do you know how crazy that is? I mean, when I go mountain climbing or fucking hiking, I like getting off the path and touching things and pissing places where I'm like, maybe nobody's pissed here before or not for like 100 years or something. But this guy really, I mean, for sure. So, fucking sit back and enjoy yourself. Just when you hear somebody doing something. Oh, I heard this fucking, so in they're doing this, okay, there's all these climate change protests right now, which I same thing. I love when people do stuff. In Rolling Stone, it was talking about it. They're doing, in London, New York, and all over, they're doing like civil disobedience. Leading up to April 15th, where they're just going to try to shut down a city until the fucking politicians start really discussing climate change. Instead of ignoring it or saying, is there global warming, is there not? Like, well, let's just fucking start talking about it and start making laws. And so, yeah, okay, Rolling Stone. The Extinction Rebellion. That's what it is. The Extinction Rebellion. They do these weird civil disobedience stuff where they just like, you know, take over an ice skating rink or just sit in parliament and fucking get naked. But International Week of Action in April. Yeah. Yeah, it's fucking cool. They're just trying to force governments to fucking take a stance on something. But I love that. Even if you don't believe in it, I love people going for it. And this Extinction Rebellion is the same thing. They're going for it. They're trying to create some change through positivity. They're not shitting on people. They're like, fucking, please, we're asking you to do something about it. But anyway, let's start the episode. Let's start. If you're in New York or London on April 15th, fucking figure out a way to participate. Extinction Rebellion. I'll be here. Maybe I'll participate. The 15th. Yeah, for sure I will. Yeah, I'm definitely going to. I got to find out where it is. If anybody knows where they're doing something, let me know. I'll come down. Tax day. Ooh, it's a tough day. It's my people's Super Bowl. All right, should we start? I think I have nothing more to add, to offer. This is just a tremendous episode. Oh, that's what I said. If I have pictures on the website, arethegreat.com, of this tremendous trek from Tim Crockett. I mean, it's tremendous. So go to arethegreat.com if you want to see some of the things he does. I also have a link for the charities. I have shows coming up this weekend on the Saturday. Probably by the time you listen to this, it'll be over. But in Toronto, there's some tickets left for the second show. That's it. Portland on the 26th of April. Seattle. Portland's at the Aladdin Theater. Oh, we just added a second show. First show sold out. We added a second show. Seattle, Washington. We have not added a second show at the Neptune. It's going to be similar to what you guys saw when I was there at the Crocodile. So maybe that's why we're not adding a second show. But Ari Shaffir Jew at all these shows. Then first week of May, Calgary at Yuck Yucks, May 2nd through 4th. Cleveland, Ohio at Hilarities, May 9th through 10th, 11th. I just took over. Joey Diaz had to cancel his Omaha Funny Bone gigs on the 17th and 18th. I am taking those dates from him. If this is the first you're hearing about it, sorry, but Diaz ain't coming. He's going to do it in like September or something. But hey, if you already got plans, come see me. In June, the Funny Bone in Columbus, Ohio. And then I think I'm going to do Cardiff. It's not for sale yet. And then in August, I got Indianapolis. I got Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then later, Madison and other stuff. But that's way later. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's start the episode. 63 fucking days on the water. And it didn't get easier when he got back. 63 days. Can you imagine? All right. Anyway, my podcasts go long, but I wasn't meandering this time. What I think I want to do from now on is if like, well, this is all outro stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, let's start the episode. Ari Shaffir, Skeptic Tank, episode 352. Waterworld. Yep. Waterworld with Tim Crockett. starts now. Ocean Man, take me by the hand. Okay, fucking Tim, back.
There we go.
Back to the world. This is, where did we do the first one? In some conference hall in a Best Western or something?
Yeah, a little tiny room.
Yeah.
In Athens, Georgia, I think.
Yeah, Athens, Georgia. So you're back.
I'm Dude, back.
I was following along. It was exciting for me. I don't know how much more it was exciting for you, but...
It was, yeah. Obviously, there were some moments along the way that weren't enjoyable.
Yeah.
But on the whole, yeah, it was an incredible experience.
Yeah, I mean, I can't... all right, there's tons I want to ask you about, but I really can't imagine. First of all, the solitude.
Yes.
How was it... I mean, I'm sure there were good and bad, so let's just talk about the good of the solitude.
So you get to unplug. Even though I had a certain amount of connectivity on there for communicating to the outside world, like a satellite phone, a satellite dish.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know, couple of times a day for anywhere from a couple of minutes to 10-15 minutes just to sort of get all the weather information. Outside of that, you could unplug. Yes, I took music, but you could just row in quiet and just sort of almost get zen-like.
How'd you take music? iPod Shuffle?
Yeah, my iPhone.
You just loaded up with
downloaded
songs?
It. Well, that was a bit of a schoolboy error. I downloaded about 11 hours worth of music, and I think I was out on the water for somewhere around about 1,500 hours. So I listened to the same songs several times, one audiobook four times. But outside of that, yeah, it was great.
Yeah, 11 hours seems like plenty, but then, yeah. How long were you on? How many hours?
I think it was about 1,500, 1,600 wow. hours, something out there on the water, 63 days.
Damn, 63 days.
Yeah.
What was your goal, 60?
No, 50 was my goal, which meant kind of rowing 60 miles a day. But the weather was the big factor, and we didn't get much weather. So we had hardly any wind assists, so we truly did row the Atlantic. Yeah. So my best day, I think, was like 67 miles, and my worst day was -2.
-2 miles?
Yeah.
That was when that storm hit?
So it wasn't really much of a storm. It was kind of lack of weather. There was a depression that kind of moved to the north of us, and it sucked all the wind out. So the sea was like a mill pond. The currents were slightly against us, and we were going nowhere fast.
Wow. I saw everybody just kind of get turned around in that.
Yeah. I think
a couple of groups got past it.
Yeah, the lead boats that were obviously moving a lot quicker, the four-man and five-man teams, the latter two-thirds of the fleet all got caught up like two or three times with lack of weather or weather in the wrong direction.
Wow. And what do you do? I mean, at that point, you just tell yourself, keep rowing nowhere?
Yeah, for me, that was the most frustrating period because you're kind of rowing really hard with no wind or wave assist. My boat, again, in the early parts of the race, weighed just shy of a ton. So it feels like you're rowing through like treacle. You're not going very fast. So the same amount of energy doesn't produce many miles, and it gets to the point where you're basically going nowhere. So you deploy like a power anchor. It's like a big parachute that sits and holds you in the water to stop you drifting back too quickly.
Oh.
And then you just sit and hang around waiting for the winds to come back. And it's baking hot. You can't really get inside the cabin to escape the sun because it's just like a sauna.
In the cabin.
And you're all hyped up with adrenaline because it's near the start of the race and you're going nowhere. So you get very frustrated, or I did.
Yeah, I could see that. Was it how hot was it the whole time? Did it get cold or just stay warm?
Yeah, so it was kind of upper 70s to upper 80s. As the closer we got to the Caribbean, obviously the temperature went up, and we didn't get much cloud cover until towards the end of the race. So it was kind of hot sun most of the way.
Yeah. How did you stop from burning?
Big floppy hat and lots of sunscreen.
Yeah, and just keep applying it. Yeah. Did that get easier, by the way, once you start eating the food and using the supplies, did it become easier to row?
Or? Yeah, the more you eat, the lighter the boat gets.
Yeah.
When I got to kind of the halfway point, I was running the sums in my head, and I took a lot more food than you actually use. So I started to discard a lot of the food that I had with me, which probably equated to maybe 30-40 pounds. I jettisoned some at the halfway point, and then again at the kind of 1,000 mile mark to go. And 30-40 pounds doesn't seem like much, but again, psychologically, you feel okay. The boat's now lighter.
Could you feel it?
Yes and no, not really. But
off a ton.
I think it was more of a mental, almost like placebo sort of effect that, oh yeah, I've lightened my load. It's going to get easier.
Yeah. 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 I would have loved the solitude in terms of disconnecting.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure at some point it would drive me crazy. Or become a little too much.
Over 63 days, it's like a roller coaster of emotions, frustrations, then a little bit of loneliness, mainly around kind of the holidays. So it was great having the connectivity, being able to speak to my family, kind of Christmas Day, New Year's Day, my birthday, which is the same day, New Year's Day. But then when you come off the phone, I felt that I got a little bit depressed because you had this kind of high of being able to chat to your friends and family. And then when you come off, the loneliness seemed a lot greater. So for about 4 or 6 hours, you're kind of moping around a little bit, and then it passes and you just get back into the routine of rowing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I go travel alone, I get lonely, but then I'll just meet people.
Yeah.
I'll be more likely to meet people because I'm lonely, but there's no one to meet.
Yeah.
So it's like, where's the relief?
Yeah. And the other thing, being a solo rower, which was my choice, you're busy doing something all the time. I only slept in like hour-long blocks, even though I was sleeping somewhere between 3 and 6 hours a day, depending on what was going on.
Damn.
And at one point, I did have a visit from a solo yachtsman who was going from kind of Europe to Martinique. And he was about a mile and a half away from me, and we spoke on the radio. When he realized I was a solo rower, he changed his course and came over, and he kind of circled me a couple of times. We had a face-to-face conversation.
No way. Off the side of the boat?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then when he left, actually the opposite happened. I was on a little bit of a high because, yes, I'd had conversations with people on the satellite phone, but to have a face-to-face conversation after not seeing another soul for, at that point, I think it was about 6 weeks, 6.5 weeks, was great.
Yeah.
And I had a couple of radio interactions with other boats that were sort of passing in the night. But that was the only face-to-face contact I had, other than the safety boat, which was sort of in the last 2 weeks of the race anyway, when they come and sort of check on you.
But
that was kind of the opposite effect. Okay, I just seen another human being, which is great.
Who was the guy?
A guy called Dennis, I can't remember his name now, but he's written a book. He's a Glaswegian, like grew up in the tenements in Glasgow, and again, pulled himself up by his own kind of socks and became a yachtsman, and now is a sort of solo yachtsman around the world. So,
dude, if I was all alone, found that there was another English speaker nearby me, and then when I started talking to him, realized I couldn't understand a word he said because he's from Glasgow, I was so frustrated. We're like, can I repeat that?
Yeah, what?
Is it the wind?
Do another lap. I didn't quite catch that. But he was quite a skilled yachtsman because he came pretty close. We had a normal conversation, and he pulled his sails in, and even though he was going a little bit faster than me, we spoke for 10 or 15 minutes before he pulled his sails back up and carried on.
Wow. That has been awesome. You going to stay in touch with him?
He said he was going to look me up on the website and email me. He hasn't as yet, so
yeah.
I'll track him down.
What a weird place to have a conversation where no one else in history has probably had a conversation.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow. how did you charge your phone, by the way?
So there's two batteries on board that kind of power the on-boat systems, like the Watermaker, which took seawater and gave me fresh water to drink and make my food and stuff, the navigation systems and stuff like that. And because my boat it's big enough that it can be used as a pair or a solo rower, so I've got kind of twice as much power than I would normally need as a solo rower. So charging like the phone and speaker and all that sort of stuff was pretty easy.
It was nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. Where'd you come in the end? Second place in the solo?
So I came second in the solos. The first boat in, which was a team of four, giant Dutchmen, they were like monsters. I think they came in 35 days, I think it was. I came in 63 days. And the other solo rower, who was 30 years my junior, and became the youngest solo male to cross any ocean, a young 18-year-old.
Damn, 18.
I think he was about 3 days ahead of me, 3 or 4 days ahead of me.
How did he get all this funding at 18 years old to do all this?
I think his mother remortgaged her house and friends and family, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, this was kind of like his gap year before he went off to college. And I think he had about 6 months to prepare, so he did a lot in a very short period of time and was successful. So a nice kid as well.
Yeah, you met him after before?
We're at the start, we're out there kind of 10 days before the actual race start, because you have to prepare the boats and go through all the final safety checks and kind of get signed off that you're safe and competent to get out on the water. So you interact with all the other teams. You literally, all the boats are lined up in a car park in La Gomera, and for about 6 or 7 days you're unpacking them, repacking them, getting signed off by the safety officers. So you're sort of sharing stores and helping each other back
asking
and forth.
Questions and stuff like that, looking at maps.
Yeah.
And then the party at the end, or together?
There's a few parties during that process. There's a kind of a bar restaurant called the Blue Marlin that kind of hosts a lot of the teams that go through, and the whole place is all the walls are signed by a lot of the teams, not just ocean rowers, but like yachtists as well. There's stickers all over the front patio doors, and they host like a paella night and karaoke and a few long nights with some real large mojitos.
Really? Yeah, I can see you've got to get drunk. I mean, you can't really drink on the boat, right?
I took 3 cans of beer and Talisker, which is the main headland sponsor. I had actually 3 little miniatures of malt whiskey, single malt whiskey, which I didn't touch because I buried them somewhere and I couldn't find them until I got to Antigua. But I did drink 2 of the cans, one on Christmas, one on New Year, and then I saved the other one, which was my own labeled beer as well.
Yeah.
A guy that I'd gone to school with who had his own microbrewery brewed a beer, and we had it wrapped. Actually, Leon did the design on the cans, so it was called Kraken Tamer. And a percentage of the sales went to the charity. So I kept one that actually made the crossing with me, and what we may do is kind of auction it off for the charities as well.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm kind of an animist, so I believe in, like, not really believe, but something in me just gets to, like, the power of a thing.
Yeah.
And when it's, like, been places,
well,
it just seems
one
cooler.
Of the things, so I knew nothing about La Gomera, which is this, I think it's the second or third smallest island in the Canary Islands. And that's where the race starts, and you go there, and it's the volcanic rock, and it's got an interesting it's got like a rainforest that people come to visit. But I found that most of the people there are artists from not just Spain, but UK, Europe, other places like that. And they kind of hosted us for one night, and all of the artist kind of community, whether they are poets or sculptors or painters, all did something around ocean rowing. And the theme was that you never row alone. So each of the teams got given like a little goodie bag with a limited edition print and some other things that were commissioned by these artists. And then a local sculptor took some of the wood, the trees that sort of grow on La Gomera, and carved very unique little statues in the shape of a wave. And each of us solo rowers got given one of these because the theme was you never row alone. And we carried that on the boat. And then another photographer in Antigua took a picture of us at the other end with each of these sculptures. So that's pretty unique.
Oh, that's cool.
And a nice sort of theme to get sent off, and the sort of support of that local community.
Yeah. How much did you end up raising for the charity?
So we've still got the sort of fundraising open.
Okay.
What I found out, like, today, fundraising, it's not simple of our call in here or send your checks here. It's done on social media. It's done through the website. So we're still wrapping our arms around that. We feel that we're somewhere between 18 and 20,000 at the moment. We hope those numbers will go up. And then obviously we set up Tame the Kraken as a 501c3. So there's money in the boat. So when the boat comes over, we'll more than likely sell the boat, and then whatever funds come out of that, we'll split between the charities as well.
The extra.
Yeah.
What are the charities? It's the...
So I've got one in the UK called Combat Stress. Mm-hmm. I think they're the longest or the oldest charity specifically for veterans' mental health that was set up kind of over 100 years ago on the, at the end of the First World War. And then here in the US, an organization called Give an Hour. The founder, who's a psychologist, doctor herself, they get clinical professionals and doctors to donate their own time so they can get veterans in to get treatment very quickly. And then they'll work with either the VA or other charities for continued funding to keep the treatment going. So very impactful organization as well.
Oh, that's cool. I was talking to somebody from the military, and their biggest problem was like, why do we have to go to VA? Sometimes they're like 80 miles away, and I have a doctor. Can't you just can you just give the money to that guy instead of the VA?
Yeah, and that's half the problem. And for its good and bad points, again, I've not had any real exposure with the VA, but again, it's access and getting the treatment and going through the various kind of hoops that you have to jump through in order to start getting the treatment, which I think is a barrier to... For a lot of veterans getting the help that they need.
Yeah. Yeah. Damn. So where can they go to donate if they want to?
So our website's still up. So tamethekraken.org.
Okay.
If you go to our Facebook page, there are several links on various of the posts where you can donate. And I think that's one of the easiest ways that some people can do it. On the website, there's buttons on several of the pages where you can click and just sort of PayPal, whether you use PayPal or a credit card, whatever's easier.
Yeah, it's a good charity and a cool way to push notoriety to it.
I've only been back just, 2.5 weeks?
2.5 weeks.
Now starting to feel somewhat normal. And it's kind of like, what's next? Because we have set up the organization as a 501c3.
Yeah.
And we're exploring thoughts and ideas, and if we can either find another corporate sponsor or partner that's willing to work with us, we're toying with the idea of maybe keeping the boat and having me manage and have other teams do the same thing
on your boat
pairs. Yep. Because obviously the boat will gift the boat to the charity, and then that will help because there won't be the upfront costs
of getting all this that we have to deal with.
And hopefully extend the fundraising across 2 or 3 years. Or we may sell the boat, like I said, put the money into the charities, perhaps retain a little bit, and look at other options. Do we set up a similar race, whether it's an ocean rowing race or something else that we can get more people involved?
Set it up by yourself, you mean? Like organize one?
Yeah. Obviously, we're in partnership with someone. It's a big undertaking. But ocean rowing is an expensive endeavor. And not only is it expensive to get a boat, get all the equipment, and be part of an organized race such as the one I did, but here in the US, asking an employer to give you 2 months off work or 2.5 months off work, it's impossible. You don't have a job to go back to. So I think that's also a barrier. Why not something that's shorter and is... that can create more interest around it and therefore more awareness and potentially more funds for doing good.
A weekend race would be tremendous for most people to undertake.
Yeah, we're looking at anything from a 2-day to a 2-week sort of endeavor. And a lot more research needs to be done. And then it could be just doing more cool stuff. It's funny, on the way back, reading the airline magazine in your seat pocket, found out that only 12 people have hiked the length of the Grand Canyon in one go.
Oh,
And only another 12 people have done it sort of over the course of a year in segments. From
east to west, you mean?
The length of the Grand Canyon.
Wow. How long does that take?
I think it's about 700 and some odd miles. So it would probably take, a couple of months.
That'd be something I could get into.
Yeah, so that... So we got lots of things to play around with. Yeah. We'll see what bubbles up and what we can do in terms of partnership with others.
Yeah. So you land. You're in Antigua now. I mean, can you even walk? What, like
with help?
Really?
Yeah. And I'll share the video with you. Throughout the whole crossing, like our biggest challenge was lack of weather. So we rode the Atlantic, but the last day, and I don't know why I felt it was going to be an easy day. It wasn't. I knew from the weather forecast that we would have some difficulty with kind of the wind and the waves coming out of the southeast, which essentially is the wrong direction to get into English Harbour, is where the race finishes, and it's a very small natural harbour. And there's this big headland, big massive cliffs. So as the sun comes up, I'm looking at my charts and I'm looking at the direction I'm going. Well, this is going to be tough. So for a course of 2 or 3 hours, I'm trying to crab across the waves in order to clear this headland. And I get to about 2 miles out and saw that I wasn't going to make it. So I had to go to sort of foot steering and literally row beam on side on to the waves. And for about 45 minutes, I wasn't going anywhere. And I'm getting pushed closer and closer to these cliffs. And I've seen these waves crash up. And it was at that point I put my life jacket on because I'm trying to call the local search and rescue boat that helps sort of guide us in the last mile a bit. I'm getting no response from them. And I'm getting pushed closer and closer to these cliffs. And I thought this could end in disaster. I've just rode the majority of the Atlantic, and it could all end in disaster in the last 2 miles. And I'm kind of now thinking, do I just jump overboard and let the boat crash up against the rocks and have to climb my way out, or wait for the rescue boat to come get me? But then the blade started to bite, and I started to make a little bit of headway, enough to clear the cliffs. And then about 5 minutes later, the search and rescue boat turns up, and they guide you in and kind of literally handhold you in. And as I cleared the cliffs, the first thing he said to me, right, I'm going to need you to go much closer to the cliffs because of the way the winds and the currents are in order to sort of get round the corner. And I looked at him, and he must have sort of read my mind that I was close to having a sense of humor failure. But they were fantastic. They literally do handhold you all the way in, and then once you're in the mouth of the harbour, you're in the lee of the cliffs, and then it becomes flat water. It's that postcard Caribbean sort of scene. But at that point, for the last 2 hours, I was kind of battling for not my life, but it felt like it, and I was exhausted. So when I crossed the finish line, you have about less than a quarter of a mile to row into where Nelson's Dockyard is, and where kind of all the friends and family and the race officials are there. So you end the race when you cross the finish line, but then you have this little tiny row in, and you're going past these massive super yachts.
That part would kill me, by the way. Like, you're done. Yeah. Like, keep going though. You gotta dock your boat.
And at that point, I'm just exhausted. I could hardly speak. It wasn't anticlimactic, because like, when I saw my family and my wife and everything like that, you start to get overcome with emotions. But yeah, it was fulfilling after I got on land and you did all the welcome stuff. But after battling through what I did in those closing stages to get around the corner, and then everyone's like, what took you so long? Like, we saw you like the dot outside the harbour on the maps or on the app that they're looking at. And you try to explain to them. And it wasn't until
about
a week ago that I actually got the video footage off one of the photographers. And it still doesn't really do it justice.
Of what? Of the cliffs?
Yeah, of me trying to battle against the waves coming in.
Damn. Who was waiting for you, your wife?
My wife, my kids, my sister. My parents couldn't make it because my father had just had a heart procedure done, and he wasn't allowed to fly. But we FaceTimed them that evening, and it was streamed on Facebook Live on the race website. So there was a lot of people watching, I believe.
Did any part of you not want to dock in, where you're like, I'm not
some
ready
yet?
Some
people say that, yeah. Like, previous races, they've said, oh, they've got kind of depressed in the closing stages because they never want to get off the boat. I didn't have those feelings.
Yeah.
Since sort of coming back, you look at pictures, you look at sort of video, you share stories with some of the other rowers, and you think, oh, yeah, it was great out there. But I was ready to get off. I was ready to get off long before then.
That's so weird because you can't call it. You can't, like, I'm done, I'm going back home.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, you have the ability to call for help, but you got to be in sort of grave and imminent danger. And obviously, there's a lot of logistics and cost that goes into a rescue. Plus, then they just let the boat drift. So with the money that's sort of invested into the boat, you don't want that sort of just drifting around the Caribbean.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were times where I thought, just get me off this boat. And I, a couple of the other teams had similar sort of experiences. And I think it was, again, that level of frustration when you couldn't go anywhere and all your efforts weren't being very productive, that you're like, yeah, I've had enough, get me off. But there were times that, yeah, you're out there and you've got pilot whales and pods of dolphins like swimming around the boat and interacting with the boat, which are just unbelievable.
What do you mean?
Yeah, so
that sounds so cool.
Yeah, so about 2 weeks in, and again, because I had good connectivity, so I'm messaging back and forth and I can see other people's posts on Instagram and things like that, and everyone's saying, oh, we've just seen a shark, we've just seen like a whale, and all this cool comments about the wildlife that they're interacting with, and I hadn't seen anything, and I'm like, what's wrong with me? Like, I've seen a couple of ships in the distance, that's about it.
You do scuba diving at all?
I have in the past, yeah.
You know when everyone's like, oh, did you see that octopus and that one? You're like, no, what, where? And you're like, I mean, I'll take you, but they're probably gone.
So it was, I'd actually been in the water cleaning the bottom of my boat, because barnacles stick to it and slow the boat down. So every sort of 5 to 7 days you get in, you literally just scrape all this off the bottom of the boat. So I climbed back on board and I'm sort of cleaning myself up and putting stuff away. And you hear that telltale sort of blow, and then kind of that chirp and squeak of dolphins. And you look up and there's like fins all around. And I grab the GoPro and like shove it underwater, and there's like 40 or 50 dolphins like swimming around the boat. I've never seen that many dolphins in one place in my life.
What?
And to see them up close, and they're not kind of that gray that you associate with the color of dolphins. They were like mottled or speckled, which was, again, just fantastic. And then on another occasion, like I said, heard that blow, and I'm thinking, oh, what's that? And I look around, and I just see this shape in the water and a little tiny dorsal fin come up. And the same thing, stick the camera underneath, and it was a pilot whale. It was about the length of the boat, maybe about 20 foot. And again, for about 40 minutes, it just swam alongside the boat, under the boat, kind of. It seemed like it was trying to play or interact with the boat. And just to sort of sit back and watch that was amazing. I've never seen a pilot whale in
Do you keep rowing anymore. Or do you just like
No, I, just, sit I, would, there. I would sit down and watch.
Wow.
Towards the end, I had about 5 or 6 visits from dolphins, only one from a whale. A blue marlin at one point came, and I got a daily visit from a bird or birds. But yeah, the dolphins were just fantastic.
Wow. Oh man, was the salt, did it get to you after a while?
So we didn't get the wind and all the other sort of
which would issues. Have been worse.
I got a few waves that would crash over the boat, and the boat got covered in salt. I got some, but yeah, you're cleaning yourself 2 or 3 times a day before getting in at the cabin to cut down on some of the things that could go wrong in terms of like salt sores and abrasions and infections and things like that. So I not really had any real problems from that side. And towards the end, we would get pretty much a daily shower from storms coming through. There was a lot of storm fronts. So you'd get little squalls that would rain on top of you, which was quite refreshing because it would cool you down, clean the boat off. And in the last few days, we had some big squalls. I had some big squalls hit me. So, again, you just take it in your stride.
Were you, did you do it naked or did you wear clothes?
I did some naked rowing. I didn't get on with the whole naked rowing thing.
No.
a lot of people swear by it, but I just felt it was sort of uncomfortable. Sometimes when, yes, I've washed the clothes I was wearing and they were drying, I might row naked, but nothing sort of sustained.
Yeah. I like it. I would love it.
Yeah, no problem. Obviously, being a former Royal Marine, we're always kind of known for getting naked, like naked bar, naked skiing, naked anything. But naked rowing, because again, there's stuff, friction, floating back and forth, and everything else like that. It didn't really work for me.
That's fair. So the walking was difficult just because it was the muscles versus also the motion.
Your calves tend to wither away, your hamstrings tend to wither away, plus you're on this moving boat for 63 days, so your body gets used to doing that, and the whole equilibrium in your ears kind of is all a little bit out of whack. So it's funny because you literally step off the boat,
yeah,
and then all of a sudden it hits you as if you've kind of drunk half a bottle of vodka or something. You're wobbling all over the place and people are steadying you. And apparently the race officials have like family meetings and briefings for those family members that they're warning them what to expect in terms of, yes, they won't be able to walk properly. They may wake up in the middle of the night, like thrashing around, feeling that they're on a moving boat.
Did you?
I didn't know. The only thing I had is the first night I slept for about 4 hours. And like I said, I had this eye condition that kind of was painful and woke me up. And I got an overwhelming sense to do something because on board, I was always doing something. It wasn't like, oh, what shall I do today? When you're dealing with the sleep deprivation, the way what I used to sort of overcome that is when the alarm went off, I put my shoes on, get out of the cabin, and start rowing straight away. And I'd row for like 30 minutes without doing anything else, without taking a drink.
First thing in the morning?
No, each shift.
After sleep,
yeah,
okay.
Each shift, yeah. Just to sort of wake you up and get you moving. Because otherwise, if you sort of sat and thought, oh, give me 5 minutes to wake up, that 5 minutes would turn into 20 minutes. And again, you do that every shift, and that's half your day gone. So that first night, first morning when I woke up, I sort of sat up in bed and wanted to, or felt that I should be doing something straight away. And I was like, oh, no, I don't need to now. And just laid back on the pillow and chilled out. And that stayed with me for about 3 days. And then after that, you just start to sort of settle back into
doing nothing, having moments of nothingness.
Yeah. Laying in the hammock with a nice cold Guinness.
Dude, that's most people, at least in America's biggest problem of going to the beach, of like accepting like you don't have to do anything. Yeah. You just have to sit here, read, get a daiquiri, do nothing.
Yeah. Talking to some other previous rowers and the guys that built my boat, because they were in Lagomar at the start, and I bumped into one actually as I was traveling over on the ferry, and he said, you've unplugged from work, you've finished off, I rested. He said, because that's important, because you have to be 100% committed and on point, because if something goes wrong, certainly as a solo rower on board, there's no one there that's going to help you out. So you have to be kind of disciplined to do the stuff that you need to get done on board and not be distracted by kind of work or other stuff.
Oh, yeah. Was there any pull to like do your day job stuff?
No, I kind of started to wean myself off. I was in the UK the week before I went out to the start, kind of handing stuff over and kind of switching things off.
So you could like be fully off.
So I could have plugged off. There was at one point about halfway through that I knew that there was a meeting or something coming up, and I messaged one of my team and just said, hey, here's some background story to this. And took 2 or 3 minutes, handed it off, and I knew he was more than capable of doing it. He just needed a bit of inside info on something. So that was the only time that...
It's crazy they could actually reach you.
Yeah. There's very few places on the planet now that you can go and truly unplug.
Yeah.
And I needed to have that connectivity to get the weather and routing information from my team, which was invaluable. It was
your team on land?
Yeah. So a friend of mine that I'd served with, it was actually his father who was my weather router, and he was fantastic. I'd only spoken to him literally the day before I left La Gomera, but he had done a similar task for his son previously, so he knew what he was doing. And he lives on his yacht in Greece, I think, so he knew the weather. He knew how to move me from one side of the Atlantic to the other.
And you would take that advice and like move around storms or go?
So he would give me sort of weather forecasts, what was happening in the next 24 hours, next 3 days, and next 5 days, and then occasionally kind of a 10-day forecast. And he was like 80 to 90% certain on the weather within a three-day period, and obviously the longer, things can change.
And who knows?
And then you layer that over equipment failures on board, how I'm feeling, so if I'm strong or if I'm like, at one point I suffered from a little bit of food poisoning. I was weak for about 3 days, so I wasn't going to be able to.
Did you throw up?
No, I didn't throw up.
Which is food poisoning,
I lost a lot of fluid the other way, so my bucket got a lot of use that day.
Yeah.
when that wipes you out, because it's a hot sun, you're dehydrated, so I had to ease back on.
What food poisoning? You had prepackaged food?
Yeah, so you got prepackaged food, but I had some food from this Norwegian company, and they use a dehydration system. So all it does is suck the moisture out of it. And I think the packaging might have been broken, so maybe some moisture got in there and the meat went off, was tainted in some way. And it tasted funny when I started eating it. But in typical Crockett fashion, I went, it'll be all right. What's the worst that can happen? And then six, 8 hours later, it didn't start kind of, I didn't throw up, like I said, but it worked its way out of my system over the course of the next 12 hours. That wipes you out.
How was the shitting? Was it all bucket? Did you lean over?
Yeah, bucket or chuck it. Because the boat's not stable enough, and you'd just make a mess. It would probably be uncomfortable. So I had color-coded buckets, because you've got our three buckets. I had two black buckets and yellow bucket, so you don't mix them up. So my yellow bucket was my bathroom.
Were you going to infect the urine?
It's not so much the urine. No, because you have a water. I repurposed the water bottle for that. But yeah, when you crap in the bucket and then you throw it overboard.
Wash it, I guess.
Wash it. Well, actually, the technique is you fill the bucket a third of the way full with seawater. You do your business, and then you tip it overboard, and the bucket's pretty spotless anyway. But yeah, you give it a quick wipe round, and then sanitize your hands with some hand sanitizer, and away you go.
Oh, like house party ashtrays.
Yeah.
You just put a little water in a cup, and
there
then
you go.
Yeah. Damn. Were there any bugs out there?
Nope, none.
And
that was the other thing. When I got to Antigua, then you got mosquitoes and flies, and they're annoying. But out on the water, no, we had none of that.
Because they can't dock anywhere.
There's nothing out there.
God damn, that's cool, man.
Yeah, it's not perfectly clean, because seawater is not clean.
Yeah.
But it's a very sort of fresh environment. There's no air contamination. There's no flies. Yes, you got the occasional seabird and marine life, but outside of that, it's nice.
What were the sunsets like?
Oh, the sunrises and the sunsets were fantastic. The pictures, I took a picture of every sunrise and every sunset. I think there was like three or four mornings or evenings where there was a storm and it sort of obscured the sun. But the pictures don't do it justice. I mean, it's fantastic. And the stars, that's the other thing, because
there's
no light pollution. So on a clear sky, I might turn my navigation lights off or cover them over and just stare up into the sky. And unbelievable. It's like National Geographic type sunsets and stars. And
have you ever seen stars like that before?
No, I've never. There's been in a place.
Zero light pollution, zero except from a little bit of your boat.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you can easily switch that off. So you get to see some amazing.
You can turn off all your lights on your boat?
Yeah. Yeah, you can just switch everything off. But no, you got independent switches, so you can turn your navigation lights off and cover over the GPS screens.
Yeah, pictures don't do that shit justice, do they?
No.
Yeah,
so that was pretty cool. And also, when you're out there, as the sun starts to come up, because you've got kind of what they call maritime twilight and then twilight. So everyone knows twilight. It's like, okay, you know the sun's either just about to come up or is just setting. But nautical twilight, what happens is the stars tend to start to disappear. And it took a couple of days for me to actually figure out what this one star, or what I thought was a star, in always in the same place, kind of towards the latter half of the night. But it was the International Space Station. And that is incredibly bright when you haven't got all the other light pollution. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, you can see it from there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really bright when you don't have all that other stuff to contend with.
Did you have a thing where it'd be like bright and then the moon would start to come up and wash away the stars?
And again, because I was out there for like 2 months, so we went through the whole phase of the moon. So when we set out from La Gomera, we had like a waning moon. So again, it was quite light at night, and then pitch black. I mean, you can't see further than kind of where your oars go into the water.
Wow.
And that's kind of eerie as well.
And you got to still be rowing in that.
Yeah, still rowing. And occasionally you get a rogue wave that comes in from a different direction and will give you a gentle tap. And then
that you just can't see coming because it's bright.
Right, right. And then the moon starts to come back, and then you're rowing in full moon. And actually, while we were out there, it was the wolf moon.
Mm-hmm. Just super recently. Blood wolf moon.
Yeah. But on that night, there was cloud. So it's kind of bum that we didn't get to see that, because everybody's talking about this rare occurrence with the wolf moon. And yeah, that happened to be one night that we had a lot of cloud cover, so I didn't get to see it.
Damn. And did you get to see the eclipse? The lunar eclipse? Or was that that same day? Was that the cloudy?
I think it was the same day, isn't it?
Yeah,
part of the,
it was part of that.
So yeah, I kind of missed all that. And it doesn't come around that often, I believe. So
that specific one. Yes. But like, there was like this exact type that comes from east to west or north to south. Exactly. Like, all right, it's all the same shit.
But it would have been cool to see that and take some pictures. But other than that, that was kind of the environment where, because after a while, you got a big, beautiful blue sea in all directions. But my life was this console that was kind of like 5 inches by 5 inches with my speed and course over ground. That was what you sort of stare at. And after a while, there are moments where you get bored.
Right.
You're looking and all you can see is just water.
The lack of scenery or mountains
sometimes
or anything.
There was that lack of stimulus. All you can see is this screen, the same song that's been playing for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and water in every direction. It was cool when we did start to get waves, because even the shape and the breaking waves, they're all different. So that again, something to look at and stimulate the mind. But when it was just calmer weather and it was just rolling water as far as you can see, and you're talking miles, there are times where you get a little bit bored.
Yeah, I do that with hiking sometimes. I don't know if you get like that, where you're looking down at the ground for so long, and you have to stop and look up, and like, oh, wow, there's a whole chasm there in those mountains, and you kind of like don't see them because you're staring at one thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you have any songs now that you will never listen to again?
Probably. I'd have to go through it. What I found was kind of weird. The last night that we were in Antigua, we went just to a local pizza joint, and the first, I don't know, 10 songs that were playing in the background, I would say 8 of them were on my playlist. I was like, are they cloning my phone or something? This is kind of a bit spooky. And it was amazing because I didn't put much thought into what I was downloading. And I thought, 11 hours, that's going to be fine. And there were some music and songs on there that I downloaded a long time ago for my daughter's dance recital, that perhaps music that I wouldn't listen to. So those songs would kind of like catch me up. But again, it was happy memories. So while I wasn't perhaps a fan of the actual song, the memories around the song was good to sort of relive.
Brought you to a place.
And then for some reason, like, my wife likes sort of country music. I'm not a big fan, but there was one album on there that I actually started to like towards the end of it after you've listened to it.
Which maybe one?
Kenny Chesney, I think it was like his greatest hits or something. And even found myself singing along to some of those songs that...
Dude, country's catchy as fuck. Yeah, you can't help it.
Yeah.
It's so lame, but it's so catchy.
And there were a few songs that, I get the meaning of this song and kind of where it's coming from. And there were some country songs I was like, yeah, I just don't get that. So that's kind of a joke that my wife and I have.
Yeah. Isn't it cool when you finally listen to the lyrics of a song and you're like, oh, whoa.
Yeah.
I just dance along the beat. It's about suicide. Interesting.
Yeah. No, there were a few songs, certainly kind of a few AC/DC songs. I'm like, really? I can't believe that's what that song's all about.
Yeah. Like, what? Which one?
I knew you were going to ask me that. And I can't remember. But there were like two or three. I'm like, really? I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, because you listen to it so much and you're not distracted by other things because... You know, how much attention do we really give something or devote to something these days? You're always maybe 20%, 30%. So when you focus on nothing else, it's you do have a sort of a deeper meaning in it all.
My girlfriend's dad pointed out we were all in Tahoe at some cabin or something, and they were watching a movie. And he was like, double screens. And he looked around, and four of them were on their phones while they're watching a movie.
Yeah.
He was like, that's too many screens. Yeah. One.
I think that's one of the things that I've taken away from this. I was perhaps a little bit more obsessed with work and into work and devoted to work in that sense. Not that I'm not devoted to work now, but that separation between, okay, it's 5:30 now, I can switch off. The world's not going to come to an end. The office is not going to blow up.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I can now focus more on my family and kind of other things, which perhaps I was a little bit too far the other way. So that balance, I think I've come away with.
Isn't it weird how you can at some point just go, I was in a meeting. Deal with it. I can't.
Yeah.
You know, and then be accepting of that.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think I was also, I was a little bit more sort of OCD, not micromanaging or sort of over controlling on stuff, but I would let things get on top of me. And early on in the race, when I got hit with equipment problems and weather and things weren't going my way, I'd get stuck in my head and make much more of a bigger deal out of it. And that led to, again, a lot of frustration and depression and all the other sort of things. And, towards the end, when you sort of let that stuff go, like, I can't control the weather. Okay, it's pushing me in the wrong direction. As long as I'm heading somewhere west, we'll make it work. So I think I'm a little more chilled out and zen-like now after going through what I did. So hopefully I'm now a better person.
I was in Indonesia and I kept missing the connecting ferries to get to the next place. And then I was like, you just got to wait in this town for 12 hours. I'm like, fuck. And I kept hearing them say this, I forget the phrase, but it was pretty much, do you want to cry about it or do you want to accept it? And it was like, after a while, I was like, no, I want to cry about it for a little bit. But then it was like, yeah, you're right. I mean, I guess I'll just find some food and walk around. There's nothing you can do. Yeah. So eventually you got to or just get upset.
Yeah, because I was beating myself up. I had a piece of equipment that failed sort of
day four.
It was like auto helm. So it sort of keeps you pointing in the right direction or helps you steer. And that's helpful when you're a solo rower because you haven't got anyone else that can kind of direct the boat. And I'd asked all the right questions and knew that I perhaps should have had two of them, and you rotate them in and out. So one of the big problems is it overheats, and then when it overheats, it kind of it dies on you. And that happened on day four. And ugh. I then started having problems being able to keep the boat heading in the right direction just by locking the steering off. I kept spinning around in circles in big seas. And I started to get more and more frustrated. And you're like, how the hell am I going to get to the other side of the Atlantic if I keep going around in circles? You literally start screaming at the boat and screaming at this piece of equipment. And then literally just need to step back, chill out. I took the thing apart, cleaned it, got it working again.
Oh, wow.
And I did that kind of two or three times. Then at one point, I opened it up and there was this like retaining clip that was like sticking out where it shouldn't be. Cause this thing like screamed like a stuck pig. It would scream at you when it was like going left and right with the waves.
Gross.
So I pulled it apart and there's this retaining clip and I went, what does that do? And I pulled it out and I tried to put it back in its position and it was all bent up and wasn't going to go back in. So I thought, we'll see if it still works. So put the thing back together and it kept on working, and then as the temperature started to rise, it would overheat more often. So then you sort of pull out your inner MacGyver, and I thought, right, how can I cool this down? And I had a small little USB fan that I used just to keep me cool in the, move the air around in the cabin. And I thought, oh, why don't I get a couple of wet towels, place it over the helm where the motor is, wet the towels, and then put the fan on that. And as the water evaporates, it'll like lower the temperature by 5-10 degrees. I did that for the last 2 weeks, and
it worked.
It carried on working. Yeah, wow. So I had this thing working, I would say, at probably 80% efficiency for 59 days of the 63, which that then gave you a new purpose, and you had a victory. So those are the sort of things that, again, I took away that, okay, something that created so much frustration to the fact that I wanted to throw it overboard or set fire to it, and caused me a lot of stress. When you started to sort of get a little bit of rest, have something to eat, rehydrate, step back, chat to my team, and then figure out, okay, how can we, what's the solution to this problem? Clean it, cool it down, and it got working.
Wow.
So
that must have been really like rewarding to get to the point.
Yeah,
of, like,
it was. Like I said, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but when you're in the middle of the Atlantic and there's not much else out there, those sort of things, you're like, yeah. It's like when I took a lot of different meals and variety to try and figure out. And there were some meals that I wouldn't even feed my dog. They were very unappetizing. And some meals were really tasty. So when you're sort of getting towards the end of the race and you've eaten all the good stuff, and I've got two big storage containers on deck, and you're kind of rummaging around to see what you've got left, and you're doing a bit of an inventory, and then you come across one of the good meals. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah! And then you sort of savor it, and you're like, kind of take that extra 10 minutes to eat it really slow, to kind of draw it out a little bit more. Those are the sort of things that, again, I'm smiling now. Out on the water, we're getting a reason to celebrate.
Yeah. Did you have your Wilson moment?
I did.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to put anything overboard. Again, either your waste material or food that you could discard. So all the trash you have to keep. I just opened the bottle of some MCT oil or something, and the little plastic clip got caught by the wind. So I went to dive to catch this, but when I caught that, the hat that I was wearing came off and landed in the water, and I couldn't grab both things. And I thought, well, that's a cotton hat, it'll degrade at some point, whereas the plastic wouldn't. So I kept the plastic, and then I had that Wilson moment, because it was at the time when a wave was coming on as well. So I just watched it kind of like drift off into the distance. And I was like, no! Luckily, I had a second one. But yeah, that was my Wilson moment, that I lost one of my hats.
As a companion, as a piece of clothing, like it's my new buddy.
Yeah. So yeah, like I said, you mentioned the sun. Obviously, I'm a bit follically challenged, so
yeah.
I needed to stay covered up, and that hat was
the flop hats are the best.
Yeah, it was great. Comfortable, fit well, did the job. But at that point, I think I might have wiped my face or something like that, and I didn't put the strap back under my chin. It got caught by the wind, and I was like, fuck. Yeah, so I think I lost that. And
watching it go must have been so painful.
Yeah, you just
push back, come tack towards me. No? Oh.
Yeah, so it was gone. So there's a hat floating around out there somewhere that hopefully someone will pick up and
if anybody sees it,
recycle it.
Please return it to the
PO
box.
Should have had that, shouldn't it? I should have written that on the inside.
Didn't they find that lady's boat? They found somebody's boat recently, like a 40-year-old boat, somebody who got rescued.
Yeah, and most of the boats today, they're not like the old wooden boats that will degrade over time. They're made from modern materials, and the sea currents, so they tend to sort of circle around. And I had a guy that I'd served with also that wanted to kite surf across the Atlantic
a number of years ago. You guys are crazy.
It was one of those years where it was something like 7 hurricanes that come through. It was a real bad season, and he had to bail out and get rescued. And then I think it was 3 years later, I think his boat turned up in Ireland. Like, got washed up on the shore in Ireland, I think it was.
Wow.
Which is kind of funny, because he's he's a good guy. And I can imagine in that same situation, like he's filming it, like these last moments on board as he's getting capsized again and he's thrown around in the cabin and he's clearly scared. It's all caught on camera. So when he jumped overboard and got rescued, the cameras were still on board. So 3 years later, after telling these great stories of how he survived and well, his bravado,
you get to see
kind of what was really going on.
It's like, were you crying right here? What was that about?
So we I know some of the guys kind of teased him about that. Strange roller coaster of emotions all the way through it.
Yeah, we had a friend who was telling some story about getting into a fight with a cop. This guy Keith Robinson, and the cop was like, took his badge off. He's like, "You want to do it? Let's do it." You know, one of those like old Southern things. And the cop beat his ass. You know, it wasn't like it wasn't like the badge.
Yeah, if he wasn't a cop, I would have taken him.
Yeah, he had the moment. He's like, "All right," and he like talked about it, and then he got off, and his buddy, who I guess was with him, he goes, "You forgot about the part how I shit your pants during the beating." He goes, "I forgot." He goes, "You didn't forget. You left it out on purpose."
Yeah.
How many hours a day could you go before your muscles would start, or how many hours at a time?
During the day, the routine I planned going in kind of working in 4 hour blocks, or I divided the day up into 4 hour blocks where I would like eat and row and kind of do all the stuff that needed to be done on board, including resting. But then circumstances like with the equipment failure and the weather and everything else, I would say a good 80-90% of the time I would row for 3 hours and then rest for an hour during the day. And then at night, I would kind of do 2 hours of rowing and 2 hours of rest, where they would still be divided up into hour-long blocks, because I would go and rest for 40 minutes, an hour in the cabin, then have to get out and like check the auto helm and check everything was as it was, and then I'd rest for another hour and then get back to rowing. And that was pretty much how the last sort of three quarters plus of the race I crossed the Atlantic.
Would you feel your muscles start to go?
I felt it was more a heat thing that would affect me. Mm-hmm. Towards the late afternoon, we've had kind of the baking sun on you, whether it's on your head or on your back as the sun moved around, that would wipe me out. So it wasn't really the physical act of rowing. Yes, when there was no wind and a hot day, that would take its toll a lot sooner, and I'd have to take more sort of breaks, and then towards the end of the day you'd be absolutely wiped out, and you'd have to be very disciplined in terms of like replacing those electrolytes and eating, because in the heat you don't want to eat, but you've got to eat
because it's calories, it's energy,
and it's important. Like, and I focus more on the diet and the kind of the calories going in and where my calories were coming from than perhaps some of the other rowers. I only lost like 9 pounds, which is surprising. I think most of them either lost close to 15, 30 pounds across the fleet. And I put that down to kind of the quality of the diet that I put in. So I had no chocolate on board. So all my energy came from either the expedition meals, which are not like your regular camping meals. These are four expeditions, so they're well made, they've got good balance of nutrients and all the nutritional stuff in it. I had some meal replacement meals, so I could keep my calories high without having to kind of digest it. And
what do you mean, like high calorie pills or something?
No, like meal replacement, so like smoothie shakes type stuff.
Okay.
Again, easy to mix up, so I could get 400-600 calories in a like 8-12 ounce kind of drink, and then mixed nuts, dried fruit, dates, things of that nature. So again, stuff that was natural and had a good calorific, and a lot of fiber as well. I think a lot of people going into the race, and the race organizers and the race doctor, when I sat down with him before the race, like, we've got all this stuff. And I can remember when I bought it at CVS, the guy behind the counter said, "Oh, you're going to have a like prostate exam or something?" And I was like, "It's all this extra sort of soluble fiber stuff." And I had none of those problems, because some people suffer really badly from constipation on board. Like, I stayed pretty regular all the way through. I had the other problem, actually, because you're eating so much food, you make...
constant shitting.
You go... normally you may go to the bathroom twice a day. Like on board, I was going like 4 or 5 times a day, and my fear was that I might run out of wipes.
That's what you did. You had wipes. You wouldn't like wash it.
No, because again, it's you would be efficient, and yeah, the salt water and all the rest of it. So I had biodegradable like bamboo like baby wipes, and I thought I had plenty, but then. Early on, I'm thinking, hang on, I'm burning through these pretty fast.
Like, you do not want to have to wash and reuse wipes.
So, yeah, no, you wouldn't do that at all. So I was thinking, maybe I need to start rationing these out.
The wipes?
But yeah, but then it all kind of balanced out. I think I had half a pack of wipes left, and then I also had some big like towel size wipes as well, which were good for like washing your body all over a couple of times a week.
Yeah, have you ever been in a bathroom and found like there's definitely not enough toilet paper, but there's some, and you got to use like every inch of each square?
Not for a while.
Yeah, you live at home.
Yeah,
that's nice.
Yeah, it's I haven't faced that, but yeah, when going around Europe, when there's or the Middle East, where you don't have those, like bathrooms are not set up for us Westerners,
those guns.
Yeah,
I like those bum guns. I really do. It took some getting used to, but then I really like them. Yeah. They get you so clean, and then you're just like...
And I get it, if you've been to Japan, like the sophistication in some of their toilets, like you've got buttons where you literally, you flush, you like your seat warmer, like all the like mod cons, it's like something out you might find on board the Starship Enterprise.
Yeah. I've never used those. That seems that cool, like though.
Air dryer.
So air dryer. You just sit there and let it...
After you've washed, then you can hit another button and like warm air will dry you.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it's a whole experience.
Read poetry to you.
Probably will, yeah.
I had some more questions, though. Did you get to fish at all?
No, I didn't. Someone else did a podcast with me who's got a couple of streaming fishing programs. And he offered to send me this... kind of this rig, like on almost like on a donut type thing, where I know someone in the Caribbean fished that way, and I thought that was a cool idea, but I didn't have the time really
to fry up something, or
I think most of those that did fish, and a couple of the teams did fish and brought on board some fairly impressive side fishes, but then it was sashimi.
So they
took kind of lemon juice or vinegar, and they ate it kind of sashimi style.
My friend, we were in Alaska and started catching fish. We were going salmon fishing on the harbor or something, or the, I forget what, sound or something. But right then we just hit him over the head, cut him open, and like put him. But then we saw a bunch of like dots in one, and it was
Pat eggs. Size.
No, fish eggs.
Fish eggs,
which is just caviar. My friend was like, "Can you eat that?" I go, "Yeah, I mean they're always raw, just some salt or whatever." But yeah, so we just took a spoonful, ate it. My friend loved it. Yeah. Every time we found a pregnant salmon, he would just like scoop it out until he just got nauseous, because you can't fill up on only caviar.
Yeah, that's why when you buy them, not only the cost, but they're little tiny tubs as well. Uh-huh. They're so rich.
Yeah,
actually, a friend of mine supporting some other TV program a few weeks ago in Alaska, and he did the same thing. They're still on the boat. They just landed the salmon. Cut it open, and they're like dishing it out to all the camera crew on board, and they were like, yeah, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean the fresh but little pieces of it.
Yeah, yeah, in moderation.
Yeah. What was some stuff that happened, or some unexpected things that you just had no idea was going to happen, either your loneliness or the equipment, or just like couldn't plan for?
I think, like I said, it wasn't any one thing. It was when they started to layer up on top of each other, like I said, the frustrations that and the stress that created. The last night, like I said, we'd get hit by these squalls on the last night. It was probably around about 20 miles to go, pitch blackness, and there's no moon, and I'm rowing away, and all of a sudden the sort of flag started to move around fairly quickly as the wind was changing direction.
Okay.
They've got a flag on the navigation mast that I had, and before I could like change course to move with the wind a little bit, and it was almost 90-100 degrees in the wrong direction from where I wanted to go, all of a sudden it felt like something grabbed the boat, and the order helm kicked out because obviously it got overwhelmed by the direction the wind was coming in. The chart plotter, which is like a little digital map that shows me where I am and where I'm going, That tripped and went blank. And as I sort of get up to grab the steering lines, it felt like someone judo threw me. So I'm flat on my back, on the deck. And then it wasn't just heavy rain. It was like somebody got this giant bucket of water and dumped it on the boat. And it felt like a giant hand grabbed the boat and all of a sudden was moving it in the wrong direction at around about 3 knots. And without any wind assist, that would be a good speed of me rowing hard.
Yeah.
So now with no assistance, I'm sat in the middle of the deck with the steering lines going from side to side and just making no difference. And the boat is just moving in the wrong direction. It's pitch black. And like I said, the light from the chart plotter and a few things had kicked that as well. Just obviously a big storm, a squall. I was right in the middle of it. And I'm sat on the deck just laughing because I lost control of everything. Everything's gone.
You're just headed in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and then like 5-10 minutes later, the storm had passed and I reset everything, got everything working again, and I go back on the right direction. So those sort of things, the power of nature. If that had happened perhaps earlier on in the race, when mm-hmm. I perhaps maybe had a bit more sleep and wasn't so delirious from sleep deprivation, exhaustion and things of that, and hadn't experienced similar sort of events but during the day, that could have been quite scary. But I found it quite amusing on the last night.
Yeah, I mean, you were done.
Yeah. What else could happen? So that was unexpected and slightly entertaining. And I think that was...
Sounds like a punchy entertainment. Yeah. Just like,
oh. The power of the sea. I think, yes, you read about it, you hear stories, you watch, like, sitting on Discovery or National Geographic. But when you're out there and you experience it, you develop a healthy respect. Like, and I would have conversations with the wind and the waves and the weather, because it was a standing joke that, the better weather's going to come tomorrow. Yeah, always tomorrow. And it never came. Tomorrow never came. And even on the last day when I thought that it was going to be easy, I don't know why, it wasn't. It was a battle, like I said, to get into the harbour. You sit back and go, okay, it's not favourable, it's not helping me, but you just got to go with it.
You got to do it anyway. Did you start talking to the wind? Thank you for coming, I needed you today, or anything like that?
Like early on when I was more frustrated, you'd swear and curse at the weather and... Yeah, really? And then you'd have conversations. I got a daily visit from a bird, and I'd always say good morning to the bird.
It would land on your boat?
No, it'd always circle around the boat and kind of swim behind it, and I couldn't quite figure out what it was doing, kind of searching for food probably. But on the last night, I did have a bird land on the back of the boat, and it stayed there for about 3 or 4 hours until that big storm hit me, and then it kind of disappeared, so I'm not sure where it went.
I know what's coming.
Yeah. And that was kind of weird, because I was rowing away and you get that feeling, hang on, something's behind me, and I look up and it's kind of like hovering on the wind, and I think it was going to try and land on me, but then obviously when I moved it moved to the back of the boat. Wow. and sat on the back of the boat for, like I say, 3 or 4 hours.
Damn. Did you at all think about quitting? I mean,
no.
Didn't even enter your mind?
No, not quitting, because once you're on the ride, it's hard to get off in the middle of the ocean. So that was one of the reasons why you can't quit.
The first 2 weeks would have gotten me. And I'm like, I can stop right now.
Yeah, but there were a number of times where, again, you're getting hit with all the equipment issues and all the other crap going on, that you're like, get me off this boat. Like, yeah. I've had enough. I want off this boat. But it wasn't to the point of, I give up. You just had that urge, if a helicopter or a massive super yacht that could come and pick you up and get on board, maybe you'd be tempted to go and have a cold drink and a nice warm shower. And then there were times that you're like, when I'm spinning around in circles and I'm exhausted and emotional, I'm like, how the hell am I going to get to the end of this? How am I going to get across the Atlantic if I can't steer in the right direction? So there were a number of those moments until, again, I got past that and learned to sort of reframe it and be a little bit more positive.
Because you were thinking about the entire length of it rather than just like today.
Exactly, yeah. And I didn't really have – I had my game plan, and mm-hmm. I thought, yes, because of the – when you start out from the Canary Islands, you've got these five big islands, and when the wind comes through – it creates these acceleration zones as the wind kind of moves through the gap. And then you get these eddies. So if you're too close to either side, there's the risk of getting sucked into one of these eddies. And
just
then,
a flow.
Yeah, and then you just can't get out of it. So I was very focused on breaking out and leaving the actual islands, which takes about 2 or 3 days.
What do you mean the islands?
The Canary Islands, where we start. And then you don't really have to navigate finitely until you get sort of towards the last few hundred miles from Antigua. But yeah, you kind of, when you hit the halfway point, you're like, yes, you feel like, okay, now we're starting to count down.
It's downhill, yeah.
Instead of counting up. And then when you cross the, 1,000 miles left to go, and then you're into like triple figures, and you're counting down like in 100-mile blocks, you can start to say, right, if I stick at this pace, it's going to take me this long. And then you start to kind of plan the end, and you're looking forward to that cold beer, and kind of the conversation changes.
Would you use like mile markers or not markers, whatever, as a means of motivating yourself? Like if I could just get to 1,000, I can go to sleep, or things like that, or you know, a specific number.
Yeah, I would look at more at the time because the weather had a big factor on how many miles you covered in the day. Yes, I was trying to do like 45 miles a day, or try to get close to that. And again, over 3 days, you may do 39, 41 miles. But if I do 48, 50 miles the next day, it'll even itself out.
Yeah, because we had nothing.
Yeah, because you're trying to kind of come in a predictable window of time. But in order to get those miles in, I'd say, right, I need to row more. So I became a lot more efficient after the first week, first 5 days, really. I didn't bother boiling any water. I rehydrated all my food and ate all my meals cold. I think I might have had like 3 or 4 cups of coffee on the way over. Other than that, it was just sort of water and kind of the sports drinks that you can mix up. Because
why?
To heat water up and then rehydrate your 3 or 4 meals at one go would be 15, 20 minutes. Whereas if I just run the water maker, fill up the food packets and then pack them away, eat one there, I could do twice as much work in 5 minutes. So that, again, when you look at that over 60 days, that time adds up, and that's time that you could be spending rowing. So I was trying to maximize time on the oars.
How many hours in the water?
63 days. I was 63 days, 2 hours and 37 minutes it took me to cross. Some days, like I say, I'm trying to row 12 to 14 hours a day.
Fuck. Of straight, just pulling.
Yeah, and again, those would be during the day. Like I said, I would try to get the 3 hours in of solid rowing, and then rest an hour. And during the day, it was so hot, I couldn't sleep or rest in the cabin. So I'd literally just chill out on deck, kind of in the shade of the cabin. If it was late in the afternoon, I'd try to
hide behind.
Like I'd wet a towel and kind of try and rest underneath that, just to cool yourself down, because the cabin was literally a sauna. So
just baking,
yeah, and the humidity and so forth, it's uncomfortable. Plus, it would increase your dehydration. So you'd welcome the night to come because it would cool things down, and then you'd welcome a rain shower most days because that would cool things down as well.
Yeah, when you did get to sleep, or when it was night, would you just be out, or like how was the sleep on the boat?
I slept well. I think there were a couple of moments where you're so sleep deprived, like you hallucinate. And at one point, I thought I had a mouse in the cabin. I could swear that I'm laying on my front, and I opened my eyes, and there was this mouse in front of me. And it was just staring back at me. And for about 2 hours then, I was convinced, I'm like, really? And my boat was built in the UK and was stored in the UK before it was shipped out. And it's in a country location next to a big cornfield. So I'm thinking, okay, this is plausible.
Yeah.
Like maybe a mouse has got on board somewhere and there's lots of little...
Can you imagine getting into all your food?
Nooks and crannies that it could have been in. And so I was kind of, lights are on, I'm checking around, like, is there a mouse on here? And then later that morning, I must have realized that, no, it was a hallucination. I don't know what triggered it and why it was a mouse, but it was very vivid. So that was kind of funny. And then there were times... I lived and died by my alarm on my phone. But there would be some times where the alarm goes off. I'm like, am I getting in the cabin or getting out of the cabin? Have I just started rowing? And I look down at my feet. Have I got my shoes on or not?
That out of
you
it.
You just didn't know what was going on. And on those moments, you may think, oh, well, I thought, like, okay, regardless, I'm going to reset where anything from another 20 minutes to another 60 minutes and try and rest, because clearly I didn't want to go out on deck and like do something stupid and injure myself and all the rest of it. So
in that state.
But then body starts to adapt. And I'd say the latter half of the crossing, I would wake up anything from 2 minutes to 30 seconds ahead of my alarm. And my body started to...
Wow. Prison time.
60-minute blocks.
And you just pop up. You're like, it's about that.
Yeah, I'd wake up. And because you're always sleep-deprived, I forced myself, when the alarm went off, put my shoes on, got out of the cabin straight away, and started rowing. And I'd row for 30 minutes flat without taking a drink, having a piss, kind of anything, in order to try and wake you up and get you going again. And then I would typically drink, have something to eat, kind of then reset, and then row for the following 90 minutes or 2 hours, depending on what was going on.
What did your friends and your wife say about this whole thing?
The team that I had, and I call it my team now, so old school friend from like 27 years ago, went to elementary school with him. He was my UK kind of team manager, very supportive, came out to La Gomera, even came out to Antigua as well. Huge help, wouldn't have been able to do it without him. So I'd message him back and forth, and he was helping kind of provide a lot of the pictures from the start that we used for the social media campaign. My media manager, who's someone I'd worked with at Turner, who's now got her own production company, she herself had lost her brother 3 years ago, so she was very much emotionally involved and hugely supportive.
Her brother was a veteran?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then my wife, and then Peter. So each of them all knew enough of me, either during the build-up and during the actual crossing, to kind of give me that pep talk when I needed it, to be quiet and just let me vent when I needed to, and sometimes kind of literally give that virtual slap across the face and say, right, put your big boy pants on and just get on with it. So that level of encouragement was huge. Yeah, I'm on the boat by myself, but having that support team around you and needing that emotional connection or that kind of human connection, I think it's important. We're social animals at the end of the day, and I think we perhaps don't give that enough credit. Yes, some people are more introverts or loners, but you still have human interaction at some point. So that came through, and I think they knew me well enough to give me the support in varying different ways when I needed it.
Yeah, but were they like, I mean, just from their point of view, were they like, what are you doing? What's he doing?
Well, when I sort of asked my wife when I first came up with the idea of this, I want to row across the Atlantic, she was like, yeah, whatever. I think she might have been just half listening when I first and thought, oh, yeah.
And not to realize that means 60-plus days away.
And when we got 3 months into the planning, it's like, hey, hang on a minute. What are you doing? And again, that's the longest we've been apart, and the kids and I have been apart. So that was tough on them because it is disruptive. Like, my kids are 11 and 13, and she did a great job in keeping it as normal as possible. And I'll say I got a chance to speak to them. So they missed me, but they saw how cool it was. And the schools were very supportive, allowing them time off kind of just before.
Well, to go down and meet you and stuff and hang out there.
The start and finish, because they realized that, again, there's not many parents that are going to go and row an ocean.
Also, if I was 11 or 13 and one of my friends told me their dad was doing that, I'd be like, you're lying.
Yeah.
That's not true. Yeah. Your dad divorced your mom. You have to accept it.
So, yeah. And obviously then the kind of local press in Atlanta did a story on it. And I think my son, his teacher gave him a copy of the Sunday paper. And there's like, so yeah, there's that cool factor then that, your dad's doing what?
Yeah.
And I've gone back into my daughter's school and they've interviewed me on the internal TV, and her classes, ask questions, and so forth. And
oh, really?
I think
what
when the boat
great,
comes back,
what a great we'll, daddy
we'll,
day.
We'll get an opportunity to go into my son's school as well and do the same. Because yeah, they were hugely supportive.
You know, you got to go last on that day.
Yeah.
If it's like,
yeah.
I'm a lawyer, what I do is I help people defend their copyright yeah. laws on things. Like, all yeah. right. And finally, we yeah. have Tim Crocker who did something that only 100 people in the world have done.
Yeah.
How many have done it, actually? Solo rowing.
So you've got this race, and I think there's between 90 and 100 that have rowed the Atlantic solo. Then you've got sort of independent crossings, and there's different routes. So I don't think there's a 100% accurate record, but uh-huh. yeah, there's more people have been into space than have rowed the Atlantic.
Damn.
And again, if you look at this year, there was five of solos in this race. I know of at least five independent rowers that are rowing the Atlantic.
Not in the Talisker Challenge.
Not in the Talisker, no, just independently for various different charities and causes and so forth. And so somewhere between 10 and 12 people this year will row the Atlantic. And then if you look at, there will be probably over 600 people that will climb Everest this year.
That's crazy, because that's the staple of
yeah.
feats.
So it kind of puts it in perspective.
The standard,
yeah.
yeah.
So it's nuts in that sense. And I think as the awareness of this race and ocean rowing becomes more and more popular, I think we'll see an increase. Like,
well, like
20 years ago when this race started, I think there was like 8-10 teams that rowed in that challenge. In our race, there was 35 teams, I think, originally entered. 28 teams started, 27 completed. I think next year they've got like 50 teams that are wanting to do it. I think they're going to cap it at 35. So there could be 35 teams next year that start the race.
Why did the guy or whoever the team, whoever it was, that didn't complete it? What happened?
We don't know. So it was a mixed pair. In a pure boat class.
What do you mean, black and white?
Male and female.
I know, I'm joking. I doubt they were.
This year, though, there was Team Antigua girls. They are the first all black female team.
Yeah, this has got to be a white sport, generally.
Yeah.
An all female black team.
Wow, so last year there was an Antiguan team that went in, but I think they were mixed. So you had a couple of blacks and a couple of whites. That, I don't know if they're from Antigua or not, certainly live there. So this year there was the Antiguan team, Team Antigua girls, and they were fantastic. I mean, came back middle of the pack, I think, but tremendous. And I think the entire population of Antigua came out to greet them as they came in.
Yeah.
I've seen video footage. My friend was there at the time, and he said he was afraid that the island might tip. Everyone was like concentrated in that small space. So that must have been tremendous for them to be greeted after, I think, 40-some-odd days on the water to that sort of reception. And they're now local heroes.
Did you go out and greet anybody coming in?
No, unfortunately, the next rower after me was the first Australian solo female to row the Atlantic, Michelle Lee. And she was great as well. But I left the day before she was due to come in, which was a shame.
It's tough because it's not like a few hours later or even days and days later.
It can be, yeah, certainly towards the end. And I think she was about 150 miles behind me for the majority of the end of the race. And I was only in Antigua for, 3.5 days. So, yeah, it was kind of that following day that she came in, or that following morning, early hours of the morning, which would have been good to see another boat come in. But Antigua's an expensive place, so I couldn't hang around there much longer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It must be.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you a question. I guess that's all we're doing. But do you now allow yourself to feel pride over this, or are you trying to like tough it out, like, yeah, whatever, it's something I did?
I think I'm still processing. It's like yesterday I started to feel myself again.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been back?
So I came in on February 13th. So 2.5 weeks.
Under 3 weeks. Wow. Yeah.
And with the eye issue and everything else, so that kind of was more of a distraction. And I feel that it probably did affect me more than I gave it credit. I thought, oh, I'll be bounced straight back. Like last week I went to the gym and then on day three I could hardly walk. Yeah, certainly I'm proud of what's done, and I'm now starting to process, like I said, having these sort of conversations and reliving some of those moments and answering questions, because it didn't feel like 63 days. And that's a lot of time to sort of be away from anything,
yeah,
and just focused on something. So when people ask questions, you go, oh, yeah, this happened, and oh, yeah, I did this. You do start to get that sense of pride and that level of achievement.
Because you're not in it and you're looking back on it. And yeah. Like, oh, that is a tough thing. Oh, that was me who did that thing.
Exactly. And when you then start to see people that you hadn't seen that have been following you and very supportive, you're like, yeah, that's pretty cool. And it's amazing.
I mean, it is pretty cool.
When you come into Antigua and you suddenly start to come across people that vacation there every year, and they always time their vacation around this, because there's this one older couple that came in and actually gave my wife and kids little American flags, because they come in and greet every American team that comes in. And obviously, yes, I'm a Brit, but I'm an American citizen now. And the boat was flagged both with the Union Jack and Stars and Stripes. So you get to hear those stories and the support from
complete stranger. We do this every year. And we're like,
yeah,
wow.
Complete stranger. And then the messages, I've started to go through all the messages that came through on social media in support of the campaign, and the why I did it is great. And then just people that...
What do you mean, in support of the reason why I did to raise money for this?
Kind of veterans' mental health. And you see either someone that has overcome their battle with veterans or with mental health issues, those that have had family members that have taken their own lives.
Yeah.
And you see sort of the size of the problem that perhaps we don't hear of in mainstream kind of media and reporting.
They it's huge. Really don't cover it.
No. And I think, again, look at what we're dealing with now. And it's not just the latest conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. It started with the Vietnam era and mm-hmm. folks that, again, came from that. And it was a war that America lost
mm-hmm.
and wasn't very well received. And again, the public opinion kind of turned against the war effort during
while
the war
they were
process.
There.
Yeah. So all of those veterans, they're scarred and alienated and all the sort of problems. You look at homelessness over here and the vets that are living on the streets, those that are dealing with physical injuries, they're in so much pain that drives them to take their own lives. And then those that are suffering from post-traumatic stress, the effects of traumatic brain injury, all these sort of things. And it either gets pigeonholed or kind of lumped in a category, and it's like, oh, well, that's over now. And
it's over. We've moved on.
Forget it. And these things, like I said, last 50, 60 years. And if you're not getting proper treatment and there's the right awareness, and I'm not a clinical specialist, so, again, I'm only regurgitating some of the things and the research that I've come across. But it is something that needs to be addressed, and it's something that requires a long-term solution.
Yeah.
And that, again, starts hopefully with what we attempted to do for this, is just raise the awareness a bit more.
Again, tamethekraken.org, if you can find out where,
absolutely,
where
yeah.
to give money. And it's a worthy cause. But can you imagine having to deal with, I mean, I'm sure you've dealt with what you've seen during the, you know, your Army days, but then like coming home, finally being done with it, and then getting spit on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how anyone would cope with that. Not be.
And I think that's perhaps where the tipping point was, because if you look at the charity that I'm supporting in the UK, Combat Stress, so that organization was set up to help soldiers returning from the First World War deal with what they call shell shock, and they had various programs to help people kind of become a little bit more productive in society. So that's over 100 years that's been going. But the focus on what is called like PTSD now, but any mental health problem, like from anxiety, alienation, all these sort of things, when folks that have left the military are now just kind of reintegrating in society. And if you've, like you said, if society kind of sweeps you aside, then that just makes the problem all that much worse.
Yeah. Man, I don't, it's like, I wouldn't imagine you could relate to what they go through at all.
It's hard, and that was one of the driving factors, because I was lucky enough. I didn't really see a great deal of shit when I was in the military. Yes, Northern Iraq, the first Gulf War. There's a few things that stay with me, but they don't affect me in a kind of non-productive way. Didn't suffer with depression or anything like that. But I've seen it in those that I've served with, and I've seen probably worse stuff in my civilian career now in supporting like frontline journalists. So yeah, I've been to Syria, I've been to Afghanistan, I've been to disaster zone from like Haiti and Japan and kind of the Philippines and things like that. So I've seen a lot of bad stuff, but I've seen the same sort of effects in frontline journalists.
What do you do with them? Protect them?
Yeah, look after them, babysit them, keep them out of trouble, and that sort of stuff. And there's this stigma, both in the sense of I'm in the military, I'm a big tough guy, this stuff's not supposed to affect me. So there's kind of those self-limiting beliefs. And then, yeah, outside you've got the lack of resources, that alienation, the other thing. So there are many facets to it. And what we were hoping to do, not only try and raise some money with what I did, but have that go through something that perhaps I'm closer to be able to relate and speak to it. And
it's awareness, I guess that's what awareness means.
And again, to raise some human capital. Like everyone knows a veteran, probably more, whether they're a family member or someone you went to school with or is close to. What's stopping you from checking in upon them and say, hey, how you doing? You want to go have a coffee? And if they do come back and say, I'm in a bad place, try to listen and direct them to somewhere where they can get help, and then check back upon them. There's a great initiative in Australia called Are You OK? Kind of the letter R, U, and then OK. And they have a lot of tools and suggestions on how you can start those conversations. And there's a lot of good organizations here in North America that are, again, providing those links and opportunities for helping people start those conversations and direct people to where they can get help.
It's really hard to even start the conversation because no one really knows the terms to use or how to, like, just say, okay. Most people, even when they're suffering, it's like, yeah. And they're like, okay, yeah. I don't know how to go past that. Or
Like I said, it's hard and it's awkward.
Yeah.
And you got to try and get across that feeling awkward. And once you start the conversation, just listen. You don't really have to do much more after that. Be a little bit more empathic. And then, if you think that they may do themselves harm or they're kind of getting worse or you haven't heard from them for a while, like I say, it's important to follow up and check up on them because, again, these things are not solved overnight.
Yeah, my buddy Joey Diaz, he's a comedian, and we just had another friend fucking hang himself. And he was like, texts aren't enough. You really got to, like, make them listen to your voice and you hear their voice and, like, you know.
Yeah.
So that people don't feel isolated because it's a natural thing. Some people fall into it.
Exactly. And
but I don't really know.
It started for me, and I don't know why it was so impactful. Like, a guy that I'd served with over 25 years ago, and we never kind of served together in any scary place. We actually were on the Royal Marine boxing team together.
Mm-hmm.
We reconnected over social media. And then it was 6 weeks later, I found out that he took his own life and had been suffering pretty badly from PTS. And that was what started me on my journey. I wanted to do something. And he and I wasn't particularly close. And we hadn't spoken for over 25 years. And again, we just reconnected on Facebook.
Right before.
And 6 weeks later, he'd gone. So that's why I wanted to do something. And then I think it was about 6 weeks later that I came across ocean rowing and felt that this was a big enough challenge to meet the issue.
Yeah. Did your training help you at all with the rowing, do you think?
Not really, but my experience and my background, obviously I was in kind of the UK equivalent of the Navy SEALs. So being in a maritime environment, small boats, being uncomfortable, having gone through a lot of pain in training and all the rest of it, I was comfortable in that environment. And then I did my own research and spoke to previous ocean rowers, and their advice was have good rowing technique, but don't necessarily do a lot of rowing. And he said, look, this is the winner of the 2015 Talisker that grew up on the Italian lakes. He rowed his entire life. The family business was building and fixing boats. So he knew his stuff. And he said, like, there'll be some people that will row 2 million miles in preparation for this, and it will equate to nothing. And he said, in fact, it actually may be kind of productive because you will develop maybe repetitive injuries and get bored of rowing. And besides, rowing on a rowing machine or on flat water doesn't equate to when you get on the ocean and the boat's bobbing around all over the place. She said, just do things that beat yourself up. Get comfortable with being uncomfortable, which I could relate to coming from my military background, and build a sort of level of endurance from like CrossFit training, lifting weights, like kickboxing, circuit training, anything that, put you in an uncomfortable situation, and then eat a lot because you obviously need to pack on some weight
to get ready to lose it.
Yeah,
we have this really fat friend Bert who he was always running on treadmills, and then my friend Rogan told him, he was like, that's not real running, dude. And he went off and he just ran on the street and he was like, oh my god, I can't.
It's not running for you.
Yeah. How jacked are your arms when you got back?
Forearms kind of developed, like quads were rock, like, I mean, no fat and
wow.
Quads, they're solid, but then your calves kind of withered away.
Because they were just in place.
Yeah,
because you're
not using them at all. And you're not walking, and like my deck is probably, 3 meters in length, so three steps, you're in the cabin. So you're not walking, not moving around as such. So, yeah, you're either lying flat in the cabin or, in fact, the best piece of equipment that I took on board, I had some advice to take me, was a child size beanbag, because you're either sat on a fairly uncomfortable rowing seat or you're lying flat in the cabin, which is like a sauna. So this little beanbag that would mold itself into the deck. So there were a number of nights that I would sleep up on deck just laying in the beanbag chair, which was a lot more comfortable than anything else on board. So, yeah.
Dude, that's the part I'm most jealous about.
Yeah.
Laying in there, probably cool breeze, mid-60s.
Oh, it was fantastic. There was some nights, even though, look at the forecast, I knew it was going to rain at some point. So I'd put my foul weather clothing on, so like rain jacket, pants, like zip the hood up in the beanbag. The boat's getting blown roughly in the right direction. And, yeah, resting for a couple of hours in pitch blackness with that breeze going, like, no noise other than kind of the waves and the wind. Yeah, that was kind of very zen-like, and you could just really chill out.
Damn. Yeah, that sounds fucking great.
Again, with a beanbag, you could just mold it perfect.
To your ass or to your legs or whatever.
So you're just there. And
oh, it was hell great. Yeah.
And then when it rained, it didn't matter because, it's going to cool you down and you're in your rainproof suit. Those nights were, I think, some of the best.
Yeah. What's next for you? What's next for you to challenge?
So we're wrapping our arms around with the fundraising piece because it comes in via all the different channels through social, direct through the website and other pledges and so forth. So we've got to kind of wrap this one up. I've got to fully recover.
Mm-hmm.
We set up Tame the Kraken as a 501c3. So we certainly want to move it forward. We have a couple of different paths open to us. Do we keep the boat? Well, we can only do that if we get another couple of sponsors or some other corporate partner, and we can pull our own money out of the boat because we've invested heavily ourselves. Yeah. And then we'll gift the boat into the charity, and then maybe we'll then manage other teams to go through, do the same thing and keep the fundraising going based on ocean rowing.
Yeah.
Or we sell the boat, recover our money, put the rest of the money into the charities, and then look at other events.
You're talking about the Grand Canyon.
So the Grand Canyon is something that has piqued my interest. It might be a few years out yet, but we've been approached by some others as well of looking at other ocean rowing races or other kind of maritime events that over here, like I said, it's hard for anyone to get 2 weeks off work, let alone 2 months. So if we can look at an event there where we can get greater participation, A, for the awareness piece and for the opportunity to raise money for a good cause, whether that's over a weekend, like some sort of team event, or over a couple of weeks, those are all the sort of things that are on the table at the moment, but
yeah,
very, very early stages. But whatever it is, Again, it's going to be in support of veterans' mental health, and we'll keep that moving forward because I think we've got a bit of momentum now, a bit of awareness going, and we want to sort of push
that
forward.
They need to have more people just talking about it.
Yeah.
So it's not this like stigma of like, they're fine. What do you mean? Because a lot are just not.
Yeah. Like I said,
it's a luck of the draw, brain-wise.
Yeah, some people just have no awareness and feel that this war on terror or the Vietnam War is this distant historical event that, let's move on. Or it's that, like I said, I don't want to tell anyone I've got a problem because A, I might lose my job or I might not get a job or whatever reason it may be. And then some people are there sort of head in the sand. They don't want to know about it.
True.
So, again, we've got to approach it from all these different angles.
Yeah. Isn't it weird how something will pique your interest in terms of like an activity and it's like, it might fester for a year or two and then eventually like, my brain keeps going back to that. I want to do, I think it's Grand Canyon. I think, or some country you want to see.
Yeah. Like I said, that, I think it would have to probably be land-based, not just for myself, because it was a big sacrifice for the family as well. So, I got to take that into account. And it may not necessarily be me. I've done a lot of cool stuff now and, I can speak from experience, so maybe I just let someone more youthful undertake the challenge and I can just be that sage advice and manage things from afar.
I told my friend I want to do this with him next year, and he was like, I'm for sure in, that fat friend, Bert.
Oh, yeah.
But I was like, oh, dude, we can't really do it.
Hey, I've got a boat. You've got the water just right here. You've got the opportunity to train.
You row in the Hudson and just work it out.
Hey, you can do podcasts from the middle of the Antarctic.
That is true. You can really catch up on podcasts.
There's an idea. There's an idea for you now.
Yeah.
So anyone listening to this, if you feel that Ari should participate, then
you would beat our time, Joe. Did you beat any teams?
No, the other boats behind me were all solo rowers. Uh-huh. So there was the other three solo rowers behind me. But there was a pairs team that came in 2 hours ahead of me.
Oh.
One of the guys I actually knew, and they were part of, they were both former army guys. And in the UK, you have this healthy rivalry between the parachute regiment and the Royal Marines. I was a Marine, they're two paras. They were also officers. And I would say through the final third, so around about 1,000 miles, we were trading lead position.
Oh, wow.
So they were at one point like 30 miles in front of me. Then I was like 8 miles in front of them. Then they'd be 2 miles in front of me. And then I'd be like we would be neck and neck. And that was all the way through to the last night.
It's a good motivator,
and
too.
That story I told you about the storm and feeling like somebody just grabbed the boat. I was 4 miles behind them and closing. So at that point, they had just crossed the 20-mile mark. I was at 24 miles. And I was closing up on them. And I knew I was not going to pass them because they would not be able to live it down if a solo Marine beat two parachute regiment officers. Because they could all double up. And unbeknownst to us, we didn't realize because obviously my wife and family were in Antigua and obviously their friends and family were there also. And they were chatting to each other. And what I found out afterwards is that they were really worried that that I might beat them, and they would never live it down. They could never show their faces again back at their regiments or in kind of the associations and so forth. Plus,
they'd be done.
Yeah,
gotta move.
And you have this piece of equipment on the boat called an AIS system, which shows where you are on the map. So if you come close proximity to another boat, it's like a safety feature to prevent kind of maritime crashes and things like that. And I could always see them, but for some reason, maybe I had a problem with my AI system, and I think there was some problems with it. So they never could see me. So when I came up on the radio at one point to have a conversation with them, they were surprised because they didn't see me on the chart planner. And Neil had this conversation with me in Antigua that I think the second night that we were there, we went to this big kind of Jamaican or Caribbean night.
Those and some fun parties.
And he was chatting to me. He says, yeah, we were convinced that you were turning your AIS system off.
So
you could get in front of us and we wouldn't know. And I was like, no, we're doing that. And yeah, they were kind of paranoid and a lot more focused on me. But, he said, the only thing, because you were rowing faster than us. But
we
knew at some point you'd have to go to sleep. And a few occasions, I'd kind of get close to them, and then I'd sleep maybe an hour, 2 hours, and then I'd wake up, and then all of a sudden they've like shot off in a different direction. So yeah, that was some healthy rivalry towards the end. We had some fun with it.
I was following along, and it was weird because like at some point you were ahead of people, but they're miles and miles south and north. Yeah. So like I couldn't even tell who's in the lead.
And I think that whole dot watching community, because the boat. That tracker updates every 4 hours, kind of during the middle of the race. And then when you cross the 200-mile mark to go, it updates every 2 hours. And then when you cross the 100-mile, it goes to an hour. And then when you cross the 20-mile mark, it updates every 20 minutes. So it's not that accurate. And a lot can happen in that 4 hours. So, you're getting people like trying to second guess what's going on and how you're doing it and what you're beating that team. And then, what happened? They're beating you now. And the variance in a couple of hundred miles, the weather systems could be huge. Yeah. So a lot of different factors that can affect you in that time.
There was this comedy game show on Comedy Central called, At Midnight. And they would give you points if you made good jokes and stuff.
Yeah.
But, my points would just jump without me doing anything, and people are like, what happened? I'm like, abortion jokes, they had to cut them out. The crowd liked them, so I got points, but they're like, we can't air any of those. That was my one note. They're like, less abortion jokes. They're like, no deal.
Sorry.
It was fun to follow along. If you even go now to Talisker Whiskey Challenge,
Atlantic Challenge,
you can like pull the spacer forward and back. You see the swale came in when everyone got turned around.
Yeah.
And you just see the back and forth. It's just cool to see.
Yeah,
have you been on it afterwards?
Yeah, no, I've gone on because there was a... It actually comes out in the Atlantic Daily... Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the paper this Sunday. Real cool kid, actually. He's a freelance journalist and he's got MS. Mm-hmm. So I did an interview with him, and he does stories on kind of endurance athletes. And we had this interview through kind of his computer on his wheelchair and his mother.
Oh, really?
Phenomenal. And you think what I did was cool. This kid like does marathons on a recumbent bike and things of that nature. I mean, great, great individual. So we had a great conversation, and I wanted to show him kind of what was going on and how people were following my progress. So I was playing around on the online version, and you scroll back and forth, and I'm like, oh yeah, I can remember that period when the boats were all, like you said, in all different directions, because it's fairly everyone, yes, they may be either north or south of each other, but they're kind of following the same sort of line. And then all of a sudden, like, it's like somebody's
disbursement,
like, yeah, boom, it's like boats in all different directions. You're like, what happened there?
It looked like you were like in a small pond and somebody dropped a boulder in the middle and just sent you each flying a different direction. Yeah.
And then there's occasions where I'd be heading in a direction, and then someone, 300 miles north, pointing back the
point of the other
way.
Direction, huh?
And that's how when the kind of wind gets sucked away, the weather patterns are very, very local. So you can be grossly affected or not affected by something in a fairly relative small,
like a mile
distance,
or two.
Yeah.
Wow, interesting, dude. It was fucking great to see you again. I'm so glad you did it. It was so cool. What a cool endeavor.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Yeah,
it was. Like I said, now. You have these conversations. I'm reliving moments in my head. And it is pretty neat.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, go to tamethekraken.org and donate to a good cause and find out more about it. And fucking great job, man.
Yeah,
that's
thanks.
So cool that you did that.
Cool.
Yeah, all right.
When the sun's at his back and the wind's in his face, it's just him and the wheel. He wouldn't take a million for the way it makes him feel. Boats, vessels of freedom, harbors of healing. Boats.
Okay, that's the episode, you guys. All right, so here's what I was going to say. First of all, again, go to AriTheGreat.com right now. If you want to donate to those worthy causes, I mean, the most comics or most people who go on to promote a cause, first of all, it's self-serving, which is fine, but this was not self-serving. He came in to talk and it's not self-serving, and it wasn't like he just donated his time on the podcast. He fucking did something major. Fuck Bert for charity for going for 5 hours on fucking running. 63 days on the water rowing. Jesus Christ. So give some money to help these combat veterans. Combatstress.org or what was the other one? Giveanhour.org. A-N. Hour. Again, some of my dates real quick. What do I got here? Toronto this weekend. Danforth Music Hall. Portland, April 26th. Seattle, Washington, April 27th. Calgary, May 2nd through the 4th. Cleveland, May 9th through 11th. Columbus, June 14th and 15th. Indianapolis, July 31st. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, August 4th. Madison, Wisconsin, September 19th and 21st. And then most of the summer I'll be off. And then I might add a show in Cardiff, but that's not for sale yet. And then I'll go real hard gearing up for the special September, October, November. That's when I'll do Chicago. That's when I'll do whatever other cities I've forgotten. Omaha. I didn't even add that yet. Omaha. That's the newest one. That's the one Diaz canceled. Omaha, May 17th and 18th. Hopefully those tickets will be up tonight. But Toronto, if you're there, I'm there this Saturday at the Danforth Music Hall. First show sold out. Second show, yeah, some tickets left. But it'll sell out too, so fucking get on them. You'll be happy too. I got a really funny opener. All right, so that's it. Oh, so here's what I want to do with the intros from now on. By the way, bluechew.com, promo code Ari if you want those fucking hard dicks I was talking about. I love, dude. I mean, I've had so many problems with sponsors that this one, there's... I don't think they could get really regulatory about what I can say because of the fucking product itself, but they're not being at all weird. So yeah, get some fucking boner pills, guys. So here's what I'll do with the intros. If I got nothing to say, I have in the past kind of meandered around for 7 or 8 minutes. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to try not to. There's no reason for it. Instead, I'll just be like, hello, it's Ari Shaffir. On today's podcast, we have Tim Crockett. He rode across the Atlantic. It was fucking crazy. I got Toronto, Omaha, Cleveland, Calgary, and, you know, whatever. Indianapolis, come see me. All right, let's start the episode. And it'll just be that. It'll be a 1.5 minute thing, you know, real quick. Today wasn't meandering. It was fun and interesting. You know, as long as I'm talking like well, then it's okay. I don't mind going long. Okay. So, well, now I'm meandering. Wait, was it? There was something I was going to wrap up. Oh, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, that's the episode, you guys. I hope you liked it. Why don't you reach out to Tim if you really want to tell him what a good job he did? Tame the Kraken on Twitter. Right? I have those pictures up right now at arishafir.com. Row Atlantic is his name on Twitter. Row Atlantic. I can't believe it. I mean, but you guys should have seen his face as he started to like sort of like take in what he had, you know, when he realized exactly what he had accomplished. It's a magical moment when you see somebody realize how fucking cool it was what they did. And it was. It was just so fucking cool. Intro teaser there. Sleep. Oh, yeah, I got everything right. All right. So, again, I'm going to try to be better at going faster. So, I'll probably put the next one up since it was a Thursday. Fuck, I could have done it on Monday, too. Next week, I'll have it up on Tuesday. And next week... By the way, make sure to see Nate Bargatze's special on Netflix. Nate Bargatze, he's one of the real comics. When I say real comics, or in the past, I've said you're not even a real comic. What I mean is everyone has the right to do stand-up. I realized that early on, like the open micers, the potluckers at the Comedy Store, some of them were just like homeless guys getting off the street. And I was like, they don't want to do this for a living. Why should they be allowed to do it? But I realized, like, it's not up to me. It's not up to me to decide what reason someone should give for doing stand-up. Whatever reason they want. But when I say real comic, I mean when that's your entire focus. That's what I mean. I mean, you're like a daily comic. You're not a hobbyist. That's a good way to say not a real comic. Those people are hobbyists. If you're going up twice a month, three times a month, it's like, all right, like, yeah, no, you do comedy, but like, that's not the real comic that I'm talking about. I'm talking about like Segura. He's in it all the time. He's on the tour all the time. He's working out all the time. Mark Normand, he's working out constantly, doing 10, 15 spots a week, 20 spots a week in New York. Joe List, Vecchione, Rogan, fucking, you know, a real comic, the ones you know of, and not like the old ones. You know, Bob Newhart's a real comic. He's not a real comic now. He's not like doing it now, you know? So that's what I mean. And Nate Bargatze is a real comic. He's in there. He's in there fucking doing stand-up. I'll have him on my podcast soon. But to promote it and just to have him on because it's fucking hilarious in general. But yeah, that's what I mean. And he is that. So if you've ever watched specials and been like, what's wrong with this? It's generally because they're not real comics. They're hobbyists. They might get ready for a special, but like, they're not in it all the time. So, yeah, he's in it. I mean, so are a lot of people. It's not like there's only five or six of them. You know what I mean? Soder, Michelle Wolf, like there's tons of comics that are just like really in it. But Nate is one of them, and he's put out his first hour long special, and you should go to Netflix right now and watch it. Tennessee Kid. I watched it and fucking laughed out loud by myself a bunch of times. I always say if you can, if you have the option, watch a special with somebody else because it makes it way more fun. But watch it alone too. Yeah, anyway, that's the episode, you guys. I hope you enjoyed it. I told you, go at Roe Atlantic, reach out to Tim Crockett, tell him what a fucking tremendous feat. Oh, but that's what I was going to say. He got this faraway look in his eyes like he can't believe he actually did the shit that he did. He realized how cool it was, and he was like, yeah, I guess it was cool. Oh, man, I got a shit. That Tanika coffee goes right through you, doesn't it? Wow. By the way, have you guys seen Us yet? I should do a spoiler alert for Us. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. Either a spoiler alert episode podcast for Us. Dude, I love a good puzzle movie. And that was a puzzle. It was great. But either I'm going to do that as my next episode, which I probably won't because I've already seen it twice. And who has not seen it? We should have done an opening week. I didn't realize it was going to be that interesting. A movie. Or I am going to do on Tuesday. Yeah, I won't be able to do it before Tuesday. So, yeah, unless I get somebody in there. Or I am going to do Tim Ferriss. I'll probably do that one. If not, if I don't do a spoiler podcast, if I do do a spoiler podcast, then Tim Ferriss will be the following week. But probably on this week. I did it so long ago and I kept fucking delaying it because of my travels through Europe or because I had somebody's like CD to promote, like Greg Stone or something like that. But I got to fucking put it out. It was a good episode. So yeah, actually, that's the one I'll do. 353, Tim Ferriss, Modern Hippie. If you want to do a fucking Photoshop now and just hold it until I tweet out for Photoshops, that's the one. Yeah, Modern Hippie, right? Is that what I'm calling it? Yep. Yeah, I brought him in to talk about travel, but man, he is interesting about psychedelic drugs. He's got some thoughts on it. Anyway, hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Have a good day, right? That's it. So for Tim Crockett, oh, we have two Tims in a row. For Tim Crockett, I'm Ari Shaffir saying so long from Skeptic Tank 352 Waterworld. Goodbye, everybody.
Whoa. 2, 3, 4. When I was young, I never needed anyone. And making love was just for fun. Those days are gone. Living alone, I think of all the things I know. But when I die, the telephone, nobody's home.
Now by myself, now I was young, I never needed anyone, and making love was just for fun. Those days are gone. Living alone, I think of all the friends I've known. But when I dial the telephone, nobody's home. Sometimes I feel so insecure, and love so distant and obscure remains the cure. was just for fun. Those days are gone.